You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
It's Tuesday morning and you're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's Owen and Johnny here with you right the way through until about 9:15 this morning. Ronan O'Gara coming up chatting rugby in a little while. And we're also going to have Ireland cricketer George Dockrell in studio with us ahead of the biggest summer really in the history of Ireland cricket. If you've got any questions or any comments you want to get off your chest, you can tweet us at Off The Ball. Johnny Ward, how are things?
Good morning.
We're going to be chatting a good bit about the top four race a little bit later on the back of Arsenal's win last night. The potential for bottling the top four has been kind of mirrored with the potential of bottling the title race. Is it possible to do such a thing even if somebody just catches up with you?
Yeah, at least Chelsea have that out of the Europa League, which is definitely going to be a help. In the context of Manchester United, it's assumed huge importance, I think, for Solskjaer now because he's gotten the job and they're out of the FA Cup. I think a bit of silverware would have been no harm. Champions League is going to be difficult for them, but they Man United fans would definitely happily accept the top four. Obviously, Unai Emery's first season in charge for Arsenal, it's something that Wenger was basically almost guaranteed to get for most of his kind of term there. And Spurs, they're the really interesting one. I mean, they gave away a howler of a goal on Sunday. You were looking at the game and Spurs were going into it in shocking form, but Liverpool weren't going into it in great form either, and I really felt they were vulnerable against Spurs. And I was watching I was at Croke Park, came back to watch the last sort of half an hour of it, and just as you're watching the title race unravel, and then, you know, for Spurs to give away a goal like that was just, you just wonder where they are, and they're in real danger of and this would be a bottling, because not that long ago they were theoretically still in the title race, you know. So it's going to be fascinating. You know, the relegation battle hasn't been all that exciting this season. Two teams gone for so long. The title race is still going strong, but the top four is definitely going to be compelling as well.
Yeah, like one of my favourite footballing subcultures is Arsenal fans versus Spurs fans on Twitter. Like the one tweet doing the rounds yesterday was from a Spurs fan account saying Arsenal are now closer to Wolves in 7th place than they are to Spurs in 2nd place, and that'll get retweeted, and then whoever retweeted that will get retweeted in a couple of weeks when Arsenal ultimately bottle this. So I'm not sure if they're a Spurs fan TV. They certainly haven't got the same level of notoriety as Arsenal fan TV, but they might rear their head now if Spurs manage to bottle this thing.
Yeah, I think you need a better Twitter subculture than that now, to be honest, you know.
Well, it's when I say favourite, I mean favourite with a heavy dose of irony.
Ironic twists on it. Wolves have had an outstanding campaign. You know, I wouldn't be too worked up about Wolves, but for Pochettino, I do sort of wonder, you know, when he was linked with the Man United job quite strongly, what are you talking about, 6 weeks, 2 months ago? After that, their season did unravel. It's probably not related, but I'm surprised at how Spurs have gone from being banged there, at least for third place, to a team that I genuinely know would be very concerned that they wouldn't finish in Champions League spots. They're moving into their new stadium. Interesting times.
Let's tell you what's coming up on OTB AM this morning. We're going to be bringing you the sports pages in just a moment or so. Ronan O'Gara coming up at 8:10 to reflect once again with a few more collected thoughts on an insane weekend really in the Heineken Champions Cup. At a top four race, a bit more depth than that at around 8:30, and then Tom will be in bringing you the sports news at 8:25, and then in the second half of the show, it says Kerry fallout at 8:45, maybe a guest of a different nature. We'll see George Dockrell at 9:10. He'll be in talking about a huge year for Ireland cricket. And then Aintree 2019 at 9:20, we'll be building up to that. Before that though, it is time for the back pages. And I'm going to start this morning with the Irish Independent. And a lot of the newspaper is leading this morning. The main rugby story really is the terrible news that Dan Levy's going to miss the World Cup. Levy devastated by World Cup KO. Luckless flanker reveals injury despair as Carberry hamstring fears deepen. Solskjaer insists Pogba is staying put despite Real interest is the other story here. And I presume it's one of the stories across all the back pages this morning. Solskjaer in front of a microphone really for the first time since Pogba was asked about Real Madrid and saying that he'd love to join Real Madrid when they were kind of voiced his admiration for the club, and Zidane has come out and said he'd love to have Paul Pogba there one day as well. So a bit of kind of an open flirtation between the two Frenchmen, but Solskjaer saying that Pogba's going nowhere.
Yeah, he kind of can't say anything else, can he? You know, I mean, Solskjaer needs to kind of nip this in the bud as quickly as he can. He said that on a trip away with France. But the Times, which I admire, I think the Times is doing a lot of good stuff in terms of its Irish content. And Gary Doyle has been quite strong on trying to figure out what the FAI board is thinking with regards to John Delaney. And he never really names anyone in his stories, but he's obviously working with sources there. And Delaney still has the backing of FAI board. In essence, what Gary Doyle is saying here, that for John Delaney to go from the FAI, it's likely to have to happen from within, and that isn't going to happen here, because according to Gary, in terms of the board, he just needs 6 out of the 10 to be in favour of him, and he has at least that, according to a source. So obviously tomorrow there's the meeting with the Sports Council, and then the Oireachtas Committee is next week. But Pickford will face inquiry into bar brawl as well. This is one of the things that just makes me disgusted about the culture of football fans to an extent in England, where Jordan Pickford goes for a drink in his native Sunderland and he's just basically abused by people up there, himself and his wife or girlfriend, I can't exactly remember, but it seems to have got slightly out of hand. But I don't know, I'd have lost sympathy for Jordan Pickford. He's trying to have a day out off the pitch, and he's just getting abused by people.
Yeah, it's open season on a lot of those players. The Irish Times leads with crushing blow for Levy as World Cup dream is dashed. Gerry Thornley's column then talks about the quarterfinals and how they never fail to deliver the goods. There's Johan Van Gran did a press conference yesterday, and the headline here is that he's got no regrets about starting Joey Carberry in the game against Edinburgh. He says it's too early to say how long the out half will be sidelined with the injury, though, and Tyner lines out for Lansdowne, says Johnny Waterson. He looks set to line now for them this week in the AIL. He's welcomed back to the club on social media yesterday following time out after an ankle injury. So that's an interesting storyline to follow up on this weekend.
Yeah, and the Daily Mail goes with Pickford as well. Levy agony, obviously, Japan KO for interesting as well that there's a piece on Shane O'Donnell's return to Clare, which Clare have kind of been slightly under the radar in terms of their neighbours, Limerick, completely dominating the discourse. And it's funny with the hurling now, because you think Galway, everyone knows, a lot of people are saying, you know, Galway can't win the All-Ireland and all this, and Limerick, there's so much kind of talk that Limerick are basically, there's so much depth in the squad, they look impervious on Sunday, and that it's a straightforward case. But Munster doesn't work like that at all. Munster is far too competitive, and Limerick just need to kind of keep their feet in the ground.
Yeah, and the folly of the structure of the calendar is that basically it's a new season in a month's time. Now granted, I'm sure inter-county setups managed to keep things ticking along nicely while teams are playing for their clubs and all that. Yeah. But I'd kind of share your view, I wouldn't be too concerned for Galway just yet. Back page of the Irish Daily Star, meanwhile, is Pog won't fly. Madrid move not on cards, says Solskjaer. Sadio saying all or nothing. Mane saying Liverpool will need to win all 6 remaining games to win the Premier League title. You've got that Jordan Pickford story there as well. He's in hot water. And Brown backlash is ludicrous. John Kennedy has labelled attacks on Scott Brown as ludicrous. The Celtic number 2 last night insisted the club are privileged to have such a class act for a skipper. And then you've also got the Arsenal players celebrating their 2-0 win against Newcastle last night, bringing them up to 3rd place in the Premier League.
Yeah, the Race and Post. Henderson backs Boover in entry hurdle battle with Mullins big gun. So Boover there, who was a costly faller for a lot of punters at Cheltenham, he's going to take on the Willie Mullins battalion at entry in the entry hurdle. It's going to be a cracking race. And on the back, race for a title, 11 to 8 to be decided on the final day. So that's something that people who might like a flutter will think of. So that'll go all the way to the last days, 11 to 8, and It looks very possible that it will, because Manchester City do have a harder run in, they've played Spurs and Man United, but you know there's a lot of talk in the papers about Liverpool having to win all their games. I think Sadio Mane said that they most certainly probably will have to win all their games.
Back page of the Mirror goes with a different angle. It's an interesting story here. Darren Lewis has an exclusive with Yaya Toure, and he says football is failing black players. The game only reacts when something happens, just like it did with Raheem Sterling, he says. Solskjaer is sure Pogba stays, he says. And Ramsey, they're going to miss you when you're gone. They certainly will. They're scoring last night for Arsenal in their win against Newcastle.
Yeah, the club conundrum. Club Cork to vote on historic championship restructuring. This gets front page billing in the Examiner, which is an excellent supplement today. And this is a really fascinating discussion in terms of where, you know, the club game is going versus the inter-county game. You can switch it on and off, the mindset and approach behind Liberals and all of it. And John Fogarty says Cork must be commended for asking the question the GAA dare not ask. And Tony O'Donoghue then has a lovely tribute to Pat McAuliffe. I spent time with Pat on the Dundalk's away Odyssey in 2016, and I hadn't met him before. God, a fella you'd warm to straight away. Just loved the crack, great chats about music, sports. You'd warm to him immediately, and you kind of felt like you knew him all your life. And heart attack in his sleep, I think, at the age of 61. Very, very, very sad.
An absolute genius when it comes to everything Cork.
Yeah, and like a real iconic Cork accent and a kind of iconic voice as well. You knew it was Pat McAuliffe when he spoke. And obviously with tributes to people, you know, people who pass away, you rarely hear bad things about them. But just going through it yesterday and talking to people, he really did make a warm impression on people. And he had to evolve as a journalist as well, because Tony says in his piece that he advised him to kind of become indispensable to RT in terms of being a Cork correspondent. And there was a lovely story as well online yesterday about how he was at a game, some Gaelic football game maybe in Munster, and he was given like kind of like first half, sort of every few minutes he'd give an update or whatever, but then it turned out that he had to give full commentary in the second half of the game. So he went into the crowd and plucked a mate he knew to do co-commentary, and he just made the most. But he was that type of fella. He'd kind of the mischievous kind of wink in his eye, I remember as well. And it's very, very sad. He's a great loss to Irish journalism.
Yeah, for sure. We'll move on to the Herald this morning. They lead with the Sadio Mane story as well. We need six of the best, he says. Liverpool can win the title, but it won't be easy. Dan Levy's saying, I'm haunted after a horror injury. Solskjaer saying that Pogba is very happy at United. And Andy Moran is saying that the Dubs are still ahead. We'll come back to Mayo in just a moment.
Yeah, pretty good headline to be fair. With the Sun, say Solskjaer, my Pog won't go walkies. So Solskjaer has promised that Pogba has promised that he's not part of a Dirty Tricks campaign. And Levy and Andy Moran obviously dominating. Ram Raid Gunners grabbed third, and unbelievable for Andy Moran, in fairness, after what he said was the first time he's actually genuinely considered it. 36 this year. What a man. You know, this Gaelic football is 100% no country for old men, but he's defined that. And you know, no better man to make that pivotal pass for the goal on Sunday as well, because he's an unbelievable eye for a pass.
Back page of The Guardian is, no issue, Paul is happy here. Solskjaer is still planning to build his United team around Pogba. And Arsenal's capital again, Ramsey and Lacazette enhance Champions League qualification hopes as Emery's men leapfrog Spurs into third place. And then finally, from the physical copies of the papers, we have the Telegraph here. Goes with a women in sports story. These girls are transforming school sport, so it is uplifting and fun for all. But most of Britain faces an obesity and activity crisis. The Telegraph women's sport launches Girls Inspired. It's a campaign to close the gender sports gap in schools and keep girls active. We can also bring you the back page of AS this morning, or the front page of it, I should say, even. Hazardy Pogba, Primeros Objetivos. Do you have any good friend or any good Spanish? I think it's pretty self-explanatory with the Real Madrid crest there, what exactly this is suggesting, that Real Madrid have got their eyes set on these two boys, Eden Hazard and Paul Pogba, and what a bit of summer business that would be if they managed to lure those two to the Bernabeu. We can also bring you the Irish news this morning, the Ciara O'Kane story, that there'll only be two Ulster games live this summer on RTE TV. And depending on your point of view there. So just three Ulster Senior Football Championship ties. RT likely to screen two games with Sky Sports to show one. And it's going to be the same situation as last year, really, where the hurling just kind of takes over. And ultimately, if you've only got a certain amount of hours in the game you really can't blame broadcasters for picking the hurling, because I guess, really, if you were to show one or the other, if they were clashing during the course of the National League, you're probably going to pick football in some occasions, because it probably means a little bit more to the counties, whereas with the fact that there's an actual league in both provinces come the summertime, I think it's just a no-brainer to actually pick the hurling. So I think that's probably part of the reason why football is going to get left behind as well this summer. We do want to stick with the GAA though, because we want to get into a couple of the stories. And inside the back page of the Irish Independent this morning, Donegal Boyle has the headline, 175 games for one national title, Moore now wants more of it. So the veteran forward is re-energised by the summer, first summer by Mayo League success there he is celebrating in Croke Park on Sunday. You've been a teammate of Andy Moore?
Yeah, under 14 Roscommon in District League.
Right.
It was one of the saddest kind of periods of my youth, because I thought I did really well when I was the first year I played for the under-14s, I thought I did very well, and I was underage the following year. And I was thinking, well, this is great, because you're going to be, it's the second year you're playing, you're going to be better again. But I struggled more the second year, and I wasn't really holding my place. It was kind of on and off, and it was only like a few representative games. But Andy Moran arrived that year. He's a year younger than me, I think. If not, he's slightly younger than me anyway. But funny, when he was playing, you know, what I would call football, but when he was playing soccer at that time, he had a kind of a class and technical ability that was very unusual for that level, I thought. Like, when I was underage, there wasn't that much in terms of technical ability. It was a lot of kick and rush. You could see from a lot of players that they were basically Gaelic footballers playing soccer. But Andy Moran wasn't like that. He really did have a quality about him. And a few years later, I played for Shiven Rovers against him in the Roscommon League Senior. And I remember marvelling at his ability to pass the ball. He was like a quarterback, basically. And I was thinking at that time, this lad could definitely, at the very least, play League of Ireland. Because I knew Andy Moran through playing soccer with him when I was younger, when he started playing for Mayo, I still thought of him as the Andy Moran I remembered from playing soccer with. And he was a brilliant soccer player. I really, really think he could have done really well in the game. But you can see the quality in both codes, in that he must be one of the best passers of the ball in Gaelic football, and his intelligence and his movement. But when, you know, that pass at the end, it was ultimately quite simple to set up the goal, but it was still Andy Moran being able to pick out a pass that maybe others would have missed. And I thought it was a lovely story. 175 games. He makes a lovely point about his daughter, that he'd hoped that they'd have celebrated him winning like Sam Maguire, and the daughter would have been in the cup, but she's a bit too old for that now. You know, but his two kids were both there on Sunday, and we've spoken about this off air, you know, people reacting to Mayo maybe going a little bit over the top. We're dead long enough. Who cares? Go up there.
They haven't gone over the top.
Yeah, they haven't gone over the top.
That's just not true.
They're not like saying, I think you said there were still 12-1 to win the Ireland, even double figures. I spoke to a couple of Mayo fans afterwards. They just enjoyed winning the game.
Yeah.
Winning a final at Croke Park. They know there's a long road ahead. There wasn't an awful lot in the game on Sunday. You know, Kerry could still have. I thought Mayo's game management wasn't great at the end as well. But these are things. You want an element of shadow boxing in a league final where Kerry can say, well, what went wrong here? Because you don't really want. None of these teams really want to win by 10 points on Sunday. You want to have something to work on. But Mayo just enjoyed being up there. The different, like the Mayo crowd compared to the Kerry crowd, it must have been nearly 10-1, I'd say, in terms of Mayo fans. Kerry people generally don't really travel, and
they've been travelling better this year than they have in previous years, without question. 10-1, I think, is a bit dramatic.
Maybe a bit dramatic, but certainly a lot more. I mean, there was no comparison when Kerry got a point compared to Mayo in terms of the noise. But Mayo fans they must be the most fanatical in the country, really. Kerry wouldn't be. They, in fairness, Kerry are quite used to success down the years. They don't travel as much, or certainly didn't. But Mayo just enjoyed this, and it was put in, you know, Dunica Boyle's piece, 175 games just to win a league title. And fair play to them, they have a chance. They really have a chance. Connacht doesn't have an awful lot of depth to it. Mayo will fancy their chance of beating Galway this year into the Super 8s if that's the case. Dublin looks slightly vulnerable. The Championship, I know you're talking about the hurling. Hurling is still where it's at, but the Championship in football this year looks, there's going to be an awful lot more sort of appetite and expectation for it, because there do look to be at least four legitimate contenders, I think, for the All-Ireland this year.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. Let's hear what Andy Moran was saying after the game. Here he is talking to Oisín Langan about how much Sunday meant to him.
If I'm being honest, if you ask me, 8 a.m. this morning, but I'd be saying it's a National League game, it's final, we'd love to win it. But you hear the music afterwards, you see the goal going in, and until you experience that, I don't really think you can imagine how important it is. And if I didn't experience it, I'd have never known it. But I'm very happy now that I've experienced it and seen it. And listen, we need to build now for the summer and try to go for the big one.
He's bang on there. Like, even from a supporter's standpoint, I think most people would say the same thing that the morning of. It's like, it's just league final. Not going to get too happy if your team wins. Not going to get too happy if they lose. And then the game happens and you get into it. And then the second half, it's like haywire. It's like proper Championship. And it's like, you're then devastated. Say, for example, if your team loses, which might have happened to a couple of us on Sunday, you do kind of come away saying, Jesus.
A couple of us?
I'm absolutely gutted with that. You kind of touched on that point there. Anybody who's saying, or kind of sneering at Mayo and their fans for celebrating on Sunday can go get a life, basically, because they're absolutely entitled to that and they absolutely should be doing that. Let's not forget how well Dublin celebrated or how jubilant they were on the pitch when they won their first National League title or one of the early ones back at the start of the Jim Gavin run. Like, it was a big deal to them then. It became less of a big deal because they were so ridiculously successful in the middle of the summer and they got used to it. You get conditioned to success. Kerry celebrated it hugely in 2017. Limerick were pretty happy when they won on Sunday as well, let's not forget.
Limerick were pretty happy, and you know, it's a bit of a poison chalice for Limerick winning the league championship after win the league after win the championship, because it puts them further up on a pedestal where everyone wants to get knock them down now. But they were. The league has become really competitive, and it's obviously the point is made that league football this year, with Dublin losing three of their games, you've basically teams that are capable of beating each other every other day of the week. And you know, The championship obviously is quite anachronistic and it's quite anomalous at this stage in terms of how the provinces are kind of a little bit outdated and all that. Like, Mayo winning the Connacht title this year, to me, wouldn't mean that much to them at all, really, apart from it giving them straight into Super 8s. Galway winning another Connacht title, it's fine, but winning the league, actually, in Croke Park for Mayo would have meant a lot more, really, than winning the Connacht title by itself. A Connacht title is fine, but we've been there, done that. We haven't won in Croke Park. And the Mayo fans, you could just see how much it meant to them. It was a borderline championship atmosphere at times on Sunday. There was a very good crowd, I thought, for what it was. And who really cares? I remember as a kid following Galway Hurlers at Croke Park, and those memories of going home in the car and long journeys home in misery are really etched in your mind, and Mayo have had an awful lot of them, and it's nice to be able to go home and maybe pop in for a pint somewhere on the way home and say we won today.
Yeah, definitely. You know?
And they won't, in terms of the championship, this, like, James Horan is a very realistic manager and he does have them believing again, but they've nothing to get ahead of themselves about, really, because they know that there isn't a huge deal of expectation still about Mayo. You talk about Tyrone, and like, Mayo were Mayo 2-1, 9-4 on Sunday.
They were 3-1 at one point earlier on last week.
I find that astonishing.
Yeah. Like, we did make that point on the show last week that was a no-brainer, really.
Yeah, and Mayo will just hope that maybe dampened expectation continues into the championship, because Mayo haven't gone away, you know, but putting it that way, they didn't have a great championship last year, but a lot of things went against them. O'Connor's sending off in Castlebar against Galway was one of the pivotal moments of Mayo's championship, because I think Mayo would have won that game, being honest, with 15 men. And then the whole season went on a completely different route that they, for once, weren't able to hurdle. But they haven't gone away.
Let's talk Paul Pogba for a moment. There's been weird sort of criticism of Paul Pogba. There's been, I guess he is the only person here that you could potentially criticise in this situation about speaking about his potential ties to Real Madrid during the international break. Solskjaer was in front of the media yesterday speaking about it. He says that Paul is a very nice and polite man, and that's why he got caught talking about this. He answered a general question about Zidane, who is an icon in France and a fantastic manager. He used to be a fantastic player and he's just politely answered that question. But Paul is happy here. He's going to be a big part here. I've said before, you like to build your team around him, and that hasn't changed at all. That's all true. What do you think, though, from a Paul Pogba perspective? Are we placing too much credence in these quotes, the idea that behind the scenes he's working on something here to force a move away?
I don't think you can, you know, I'm trying to look for the quotes again now. I don't think you can put too much credence into them, because they are of the flirtatious nature. And, whether, you know, you can clearly take you know, quotes completely into a context, remove A, remove C, and B in the middle doesn't represent what he said at all. But Pogba doesn't need to answer like that. He can basically pour cold water on it, and it's a story, but it's not much of a story. And, you know, I don't have a lot of faith in Pogba as a character. I thought he was a disgrace for Jose Mourinho. Whatever about Mourinho or what his relationship with Mourinho was, he was playing for Manchester United, he was playing for his wages, he was playing for the fans, and his body language was shambolically at odds with the professional for much of his time this season before Mourinho was gone. He's obviously improved for Solskjaer, but long term, I wouldn't have much faith in him in terms of consistency. And this stuff with Real Madrid, if there's any loyalty left in football, he certainly owes Manchester United something, because they kind of chose him over Mourinho. If they say no player is bigger than the club, but Pogba, in the sad reality of the game, is huge for Manchester United at the moment in terms of bringing in money, and they kind of sided with him despite the fact that he was grossly unprofessional. We remember that Instagram post or whatever it was on social media when Mourinho lost his job. That was a classless thing to do. He's played well, in fairness, for Solskjaer, apart from few games, particularly Wolves in the Cup, he was very, very poor. But I don't see what Solskjaer can do here except say that he trusts Pogba and give him all the love that he seems to need and requires. But I wouldn't have much faith that he wouldn't go to Real Madrid.
Zidane's been stirring the pot nicely here. His quotes talking about how Pogba's not part of my squad, but then in the very same quote goes on to say, maybe if he wants to come here one day, why shouldn't he come here to Real Madrid? Not exactly, you know, sitting on the fence there saying he should, if he was ever interested, come on board a ship. Like, it would be an interesting dynamic. I mean, the fact that Paul Pogba's got a good thing going on with Solskjaer at the moment, is the general manager, is Zinedine Zidane really that close to Solskjaer as opposed to Jose Mourinho? Is he really going to be the person who puts his arm around the shoulder of the player? Granted, he's created a far better atmosphere in the Real Madrid dressing room and manages to pander to egos better than any manager we've seen in recent times in world football. Is that necessarily the same thing, though, as, say, the atmosphere that Solskjaer has created at United?
No, I'm not so sure.
I'm not so sure that Zidane is that far away from the tough disciplinarian that, say, Jose Mourinho would have been.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but pandering to egos is certainly the right kind of phrase there. Whether he wants Pogba in that dressing room or not, I would be very wary of signing Pogba unless, obviously, he is a world-class player, but you don't necessarily need him in terms of the kind of, I don't know, psychological imbalance that can probably take over a dressing room with somebody who's so tricky, and he is very, very tricky to deal with. We can tell that. And if you're a manager, you know, do you really want the potential for that imbalance? I don't know, I'd be a little bit wary. Hazard is probably a slightly different case. I think Hazard has generally played well for Chelsea, generally, and he's definitely going to leave. The two of them signing will be quite incredible, but I suppose Pogba might just fancy living in Spain as well. Who knows? I don't know. I'd be worried for Manchester United how this might end up. But having said that, if they lose him, I think they'll be gaining in another way, and that just he's gone and get back to basics, because they've a very good bunch of players who are playing for Solskjaer at the minute. Like, and that's the main positive. I think they're very much united behind him and they're giving their all, because they certainly weren't for Mourinho.
No, for sure. All right, that's it from this morning's sports pages. We are moving on to rugby next with Ronan O'Gara. And first, here's Brian O'Driscoll talking Jacob Stockdale on last night's show.
Unforgivable was the phrase you came out of your mouth on BT.
Yeah. I think in the context of being over the line, of course you're going to forgive someone like him for all that he's achieved, and this is one moment, this is one blip. But I suppose in the context of, you can't be forgiven for not getting the ball down when you're 4 metres over the line and there's barely a tackle being put on you. Maybe that sounds like a contradiction, but I'm trying to take the incident in isolation. I must say I was unbelievably impressed with how he didn't allow it to affect the rest of his game. He had some really big moments. You could see him after the final whistle that he knew the impact of his error. Mm. And it's, you know, he's had this meteoric rise and barely put a foot wrong. And, you know, he's not impervious to criticism and he's not impervious to errors. And when it does happen, you know, you'll get scrutinized with that as well as the upside when he scores against the All Blacks. But it's got to be a big learning curve for him. And it was a real get out of jail card for Leinster. In my career, I had one where I was just going over the line and Rapini Kaukanabuka slapped it out of my hand. But no one remembers that because we beat Agen by 90 points and I scored a hat-trick on the day, so I never scored four in another game thereafter, but no one remembers that. No. I do, and I was embarrassed by it, but yeah, it's just that everyone's watching, everyone in Europe was watching this, and it was such a pivotal moment.
It's remarkable that somebody can even kind of move themselves, even get in position and actually take the next pass after something like that happens. It's really ground opening up moment, or you'd love for that to happen at that moment. Like, he mentions that moment for him there, O'Driscoll, where the ball gets slapped out of his hand. It's a bit different.
Oh, totally different, yeah. Unfortunately, he just knows it was one of them things that he probably won't be able to explain why it happened. It's going to be a bit of character building for him now, and so pivotal in the game as well. I was actually at the game, and there was, Ulster were really believing that they could pull it off. Leinster were miles off their best, and I think Brian O'Driscoll probably initially came out, I think he said he was a bit maybe harder on him. He said it was unforgivable in his post-race match analysis, but he's probably come down a bit in it now and just said that these things do happen, and you need, as a manager and as a teammate, you need to put your hand around him and say, listen, your overall contribution more than allows you to make the odd mistake, and you know, you build from that.
Yeah, like, is unforgivable too harsh?
Yeah. It's, I mean, if unforgivable is when you do something that's like punch a lad, where basically there's no need to do this, like, and you let your teammates down by making their job next to impossible by being off the pitch. Unforgivable on the basis of an individual mistake that just happened. No, that's not unforgivable.
There was a sense that the way, like, I was there as well on Saturday night, the sense that this really felt like one opportunity. It became apparent very early in the game, the way the Ulster crowd were, that this, and they sensed this, was a huge a huge chance for them, especially with Johnny Sexton not there, who was going to be the person who changes the game for Leinster. That chance, like, as we discovered, it's a pretty ballsy out half there in Ross Byrne anyway, but even just the lack of the Sexton aura on the pitch, there was a sense that if we get ahead here, we actually have a chance of holding on.
Yeah, and there was probably a bit of a spillover with Sexton from the Six Nations as well, that Leinster just came into this game with a few question marks against them. And just, what were there, like five or six lads in the Leinster team, or Ulster team, who'd played for Leinster. Huge motivation there. Massive Ulster crowd as well. You really got that sense that they were going to enjoy themselves. And there was a strange narrative as well, as, in terms of all this Brexit debate that's going on and on and on. You've all these Ulster rugby fans coming down to Dublin and really intend to say, you know, that the future is a little bit uncertain up here, but we're still very proud of following Ulster. And there was a great atmosphere at the ground, I have to say. And Leinster got away with it. If they go on and win it this year, they look back and say, we actually got away with that.
Yeah, for sure. Like, you kind of ride your luck in those situations like that. But also, as well, they displayed a sort of character of winners that, you know, like, the sort of sense that these people have won this tournament last year, and this is in the last couple of minutes when they had the ball in hand. And it was quite striking, actually, watching how they close out the game as to how Munster closed out the game earlier on in the afternoon with Munster. And there's nothing wrong with it, it's box kick after box kick, and maybe not even that regular, but they just want to get the ball out of territory. Whereas with Leinster, it's much more ball in hand, it's much more of a sense of, we're going to be fine here, let's just not mess up, and we'll back ourselves to not mess up.
I'm not sure you'd say there's nothing wrong with the box kick, because against imagine now, Ron will know this better than me, but against better teams, you're clearly vulnerable. You want to keep the ball, and Leinster were comfortable in the last few minutes. They looked like they were managing the game, and that's that bit of experience where they are winners and they knew what to do. But you kind of started to really feel for Ulster at that stage, because you were like, the game was being bled away. Interesting enough, I didn't think Mayo handled it that well against Kerry. I thought they took pot shots, and really when they should have been keeping the ball. Dublin are unbelievably good at this. When they go ahead, they just bleed the life out of you. Mayo showed a bit of an experience there. I think they hit the ball in the goalie's hands twice when they were leading in the last 5 minutes, which is unforgivable, really. And that's something that James Horan could work on. But Leinster knew how to get over the line, but they limped over the line in a way as well, because they got out of jail.
Ronan O'Gara, how's it going?
Hi, Owen. Hi, Johnny.
How are you?
We've just been speaking there about the Stockdale error on Saturday evening. Johnny just referred to it there as a character building exercise from a Stockdale perspective. I guess that's exactly what it is in the long term, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't see the game live, so I watched the game just yesterday, it was an exceptional piece of play, but obviously didn't get the ultimate reward, I think, because people were talking about it was similar to Freddie Burns. For me, it had nothing to do with the Freddie Burns incident. I thought it was completely different, and I think he was playing an instinct in the fact that he had beaten so many defenders, and probably one of his traits is that he scores like that. Obviously, a left winger going in with his left hand and putting the ball down, and it just fell out of his hand. You know, I think other people can say he can dive, but he's gone at such pace there, and I'd say he's just so relieved to beat so many defenders and look upon a brilliant piece of play, and then all of a sudden he loses control for a little fraction of a second and pays a really heavy price, because it's an unfortunate thing to happen to any young player.
It's interesting that you say he was playing on instinct there, that a skill like that, to a player of his quality, should obviously be based on instinct. He shouldn't have to think about the technical aspect of it too much. And I don't want to read into it too much either, but is there a sense now that he has to kind of work a little bit more on how he thinks about the technical aspects in terms of carrying things out in the middle of a game, which seem to the rest of us very, very basic?
Yeah, I suppose it happened so quickly, I think people forget that. And we're all experts sitting on the couch looking at him, kind of going, why didn't he die? But like, you look among the people he beat in such a short space of time as well. And then he composed himself to keep it, I suppose, at that 30, over 30, 33 kilometres an hour. and being put in the ball down, and he nearly got it down, you know. It was close.
Yeah.
Incredible play. Yeah, it wasn't like it was, oh, you know, what's that turkey doing? It fell out of his hands. There's nothing like that. It was very few people in the world would have got into that position in the first place. And I was kind of asking myself, what do you do in that position? And an immediate answer didn't jump to mind, because if he jumps or dives at that speed, the fact that can he injure himself? Can he bring the dead ball line into play? So in that regard, it was really, really, I think, difficult to know exactly what to do.
Was there an element as well? I was thinking this at the time, and remember watching rugby when I was younger. Was there an element, Ronan, that back in the days before video analysis, that's a try probably?
Yeah.
Nine times out of ten, that's a try.
Yeah, I would say. So we're going to just fix Ronan's Skype there and get back to me.
The two lads I was watching it with, I said to them, I'm not sure he's grounded that. And they didn't see it at the time. And then they're like, I think you might be right here. Now, I wasn't sure, but I was like, I'm just not 100% sure he grounded that. But then the more you watch, it's like, oh, no, they're in big trouble here. But I think with Stockdale as well, there was so much, like, he was playing so well, the crowd were roaring him on, he was full of confidence going over the line, and he felt at that moment, I will ground this. It was almost like maybe a little bit of overconfidence just in the heat of the moment, where he thought, I'm going to get this down. But you're talking inches, like, and you needed, you know, a microscopic analysis to find out that he didn't, it was so, so close. And it was just one of the moments for him, like, it was, I totally forgive him. I think his adrenaline maybe got the better of him in that moment.
Yeah, like, it is an occupational hazard of being a professional sports person, that there will be moments, Ronan, where you just want the ground to open up and swallow you whole. And I'd imagine, being a former out half, that moment happens more often than others. Like, how do you deal with that sense of responsibility?
Yeah, I know that feeling well. And it is a horrible feeling. But I suppose the other side of it too is that in the position that he plays in, he's equivalent to Van Nistelrooy or Thierry Henry. His strike rate is that good in terms of a try score. So that is his bread and butter, scoring tries, and that's what he gets paid for, and that's what he gets picked on the teams for, and that's what he's going to hopefully do for the World Cup for the country. So he's going to probably have to get a routine, same as what happened potentially myself in Twickenham 2000, when in hindsight, you learn a brutal lesson, but you'd wish that it didn't have such a heavy consequence. 9-8 beaten in the final, scored 0 points, kicked 0 out of 4 in a high pressured game, which ultimately deprived great teammates of a Heineken Cup medal. And you know, I mean, I think you can go one or two ways. As a kicker, it's probably a little bit different, but I think for me on it was, I got great advice from Keith Wood, who was kind of, pressure would strike again, but it might only hit you once a season. And you can brush it under the carpet, or you can take the lessons out of it. And basically, you've got to have a technique that's bulletproof that you can call on, because you can get away with it in the pool stages, get away with it maybe quarterfinal, and ultimately, Jacob didn't get away with it in this game, but it didn't. I don't think it cost Ulster the game. There would have been a response from Leinster, and let's not make any mistake in that front. 37 games, it's midway through a competitive game where... You mean Leinster were tested, but really were they that tested?
Right.
I don't know. I think they finished out the game comfortably. Go on, sorry.
Sorry, we might come back to that in just a moment. I just wanted to pick you up on Twickenham in 2000 again, because it actually, I thought it'd strike me there that the learnings that Jacob Stockdale will take from this is kind of based on the magnitude of the error. Like, you say it had huge consequence what happened in Twickenham in 2000. Like, would you have learnt as much if it was a game of less consequence, for example?
Well, I think we'll find that out. I think, and there's a saying which sports people use, I think, that, you know, I mean, great teams lose once, but the great teams don't lose twice in a row. So if he was to go out and do it in his next big game, you'd have to ask question marks about his temperament and the fact that has he really learned? And I agree with Johnny in the fact that I think it was... I don't think there was any... I know for a fact there wasn't any showboating or any, I think, I think he did 99 of 100 of things right, and I think he lost it at the final placement, which at that speed, I forgive him. I think it can happen to anyone. I think genuinely I would say move on.
When we speak about moments of great responsibility and stepping up to the plate and the potential consequence of big events, I mean, you can look at Ross Byrne's performance in that kick while cramping up on Saturday night as well. When you're looking at that, when you're looking at his decision to go for the post in that moment, are you saying absolutely bang on there, correct call? Would you have done that?
Yeah, it was great, and I think that's a great trait in any young player, especially a young 10 who's probably filling in for another great player, and that has its own pressures. But I think the fact that between the 70th and 80 minutes, money time in a knockout cup final, and a capacity for your 10 to do that speaks volumes for his temperament. And he nailed it. It was the middle of the middle. And what a great kick and a great lift to his forwards. And the learnings for Ross in that situation would be, why am I cramping? So there's another lesson for him to take out of it in terms of, it's a quarter final. Obviously, he had a lot of nervous energy going into it, but a fit young fella like that, I think, there's probably some areas of learnings he can get out of that as well, in the fact that he needs to be able to manage that ship for 80 minutes, because it could have gone pear-shaped without him on the pitch, because you need to, in that situation, Noel Reid and all the other backs were being used, so it's a key man to lose with 8 minutes to go.
Yeah, like, it's interesting wondering what the mindset is of a young player like that in that situation, because, like, reading John Cooney's quotes in the Irish Times on Saturday morning, he was saying that the way he's become a better kicker is actually thinking of all the people who've been in that position before him and have failed, that if he fails with this particular kick, there will be another person after him, and there'll be another person after that. That I wonder if that puts it into a little bit more context and takes the pressure off in a moment like that.
Yeah, well, kickers are mad. Mm. Every single one, you know what I mean? It's such a fascinating subject. In fact, some days it's so easy and you're doing the exact same thing the next day and you're going, why am I missing? But that's the beauty of it, I think, the fact that you do your prep, you do your mental work, and you do your routine, and you get better at it by putting yourself in more difficult scenarios that hopefully when the pressure comes on, you know, you can count on it, and the buzz you get out of that, kicking in front of 80,000 people with 7 seconds left on the clock or whatever, that stimulates you for 3 years. And you know you won't get that, but then the kind of madness in you as you get older, you need that kind of adrenaline rush and you need that buzz. And that's what a lot of these kickers in Ireland now are on the road to. I think there's a new breed of them coming through and they're stepping up nicely. And the mind is so powerful that it plays tricks in you, and you have to find something that works for you, and what works for me won't work for Wilkinson, won't work for Carter, won't work for Stephen Jones. So it's a very personalised subject where you can give an opinion, but is it really, really the truth? Because you can tell lies to a lot of people, but you can't cheat yourself in kicking.
What is it that you told yourself in those situations?
Is it repeatable? Ronan O'Gara said to Ron O'Gara.
That was an interesting chat. Yeah, but I think it's that people ask what experience is, and I got a great, I think, lesson in 2001 in the Lions Tour. Neil Jenkins could barely walk. Actually, he was on a lot of injections a day to keep him kind of out of a wheelchair because his knees were gone, swollen. And I remember Graham Henry going to me, if there's a penalty kick with 3 minutes to go or 8 minutes to go or 10 minutes to go, I'm back in Jenks to kick this. And how right he was. But at the time, you're like, oh, geez, no, he can barely walk. He can't move. But that's what big games are won by. You know, I think it's such an interesting topic in the fact that, you know, you're playing as a team sport and then all of a sudden it's like you're on the 18th tee in Augusta and you got to hit the fairway and then your next one has to go on the green. That's your kind of mindset. You kind of know that this comes down to me now. And at a while, for years, I hated it, but I loved the responsibility of it and the thought of giving the tee to someone else would break you. But after a while, you're just kind of going, oh yes, this is so good.
Would you have faith in Ross Byrne now as the heir apparent at Leinster, looking at how he's developed as a player and in terms of coming through that test on Saturday?
Yeah, I think the great thing about him is that he's got better and he's still getting better, and I think there's a more growth in him, and I think he's lucky in the fact that his natural style is kind of a game manager and a game controller and a structured player, and then having the capacity to work with Cantapomi every day would be a huge benefit to him, because they're very different stylists and very different minds, I would think. And I think if you could mix the two of them, it would be really interesting. So he's in really good hands there. And I think you can look at, he nearly has a point of difference already in the fact that you can really count on him for nailing his kicks at goal, and you can really count on him for nailing a cross kick, which inevitably he's a points gatherer, which is a very underrated attribute in a lot of tens. So I think he scored, was it 16 points at the weekend? Which is really helpful for the team, no matter what else he does in the game. If it does what it says on the tin and he knocks it over, I think it's a big plus for his teammates and for his staff.
Ronan, I'm keen to get your take on Munster's performance on Saturday in Murrayfield. Like, the general sense coming away from that game, I'd say, from Edinburgh's perspective, was that they deserved to win the game, and that Munster, it was kind of a smash and grab from their perspective. But I do wonder if it just kind of showed that this is a pure and utter trust that the Munster have in Johan van Graan's game plan. And sure, they got a bit of luck, but they stuck with the plan and they saw the whole thing out, and when they got their opportunity, they struck.
Yeah, and I must admit, Owen, I was so annoyed. The alarm was set for 1:45. I was up and I couldn't get it, so I had to bloody watch it yesterday. And watching a game knowing the result is
terrible.
Yeah, exactly. You know, your mind is made up on a lot of things already, you know. So to give an honest appraisal of it, watching it live, obviously I don't have those inner sentiments about the game. So I think, you know, watching it back, if Edinburgh had won the game, Munster couldn't have any complaints. But the beauty of Munster is that it's their 14th semi-final, and there's a reason. There is a reason for that, and the reason is character. The boys play for each other. They've always played for each other, and it's such a great attribute. Do they have to improve their game before Saracens? Yes, everyone knows that. But Cup rugby is very different to any other rugby in the fact of Pro 14 season, and no relation to what goes on. And I think Munster found a way to win. Earlsey found a way to win, being very specific about it. And I think you have a guy there that's, you know, I mean, for at 31, he's playing the best rugby of his life.
You said it'll have to improve for Saracens. Of course they will. But the intriguing thing going into this in a cup perspective is that it's the best attack in Europe at the moment versus one of the best defences in Europe at the moment. Like, which side would you rather be on going into a cup semi-final? The best defence or the best attack?
Well, defence wins the championship. But also what we know is that you have to score tries. Munster aren't scoring enough tries probably at the minute. You look at Ardsy getting obviously two the last day. But they just need to, and I think genuinely that they're kind of in bonus territory now, and that's not damning of them, because anyone who's an ex-player of them, and we've hopefully set the bar pretty high there, where winning silverware is what it's all about. But I think Munster are a common team, are a common force. I think their performance in Thomond Park at Christmas time against Leinster will give them confidence, and I think they realise that there's a big game or two in them, and they're 160 minutes away from lifting it. And I think that will change their mentality. The pressure will be more on Saracens than it will on Munster. And the big winner of the weekend was Tyler Blyendahl, who came in cold from 35 minutes and showed his class. And probably people were probably scratching their head about, why is he being kept on, retained, or why is he injured for 2 years? But he essentially got Munster to a semi-final the last year with a big performance.
How beneficial is it from Van Grant's perspective to have two out-halves that are not only of great quality but differ in how they play quite significantly as well, that there is almost a plan B that comes with replacing your out-half?
Yeah, that's the benefit of it, I suppose, but that's, I suppose, Carberry's a bit of a freak in the way he plays 10. I think he has the speed and agility and footwear of an outside back, while a lot of the old school 10s were more platters like myself. I'm not saying Tyler is like that, but he's well able to manage a game, and I think to kick that conversion speaks volumes for him, because you know, I think it opens all kinds of possibilities in the ref's mind, especially a French ref, when you're 2 points up away from home. But when you're 4 points up, the rules change, and you can cheat to the point where, you know what I mean, a half a metre off the offside line doesn't really matter. If he pings you, they can't kick at... they can't kick at goal, they'll be kicking to the corner. So I think, yeah, they have two, do have Ann Butcher, and they have JJ Hanrahan as well, who, you know what I mean, is obviously frustrated that he's not getting as much game time as he'd like. So the good thing about them, they've competition for places, which means that the games between now and Saracens are important to guys, because you can see that, I would say it's a long shot that Joey Carberry will be starting now the next day.
Is there anything you see in this Munster team that reminds you at all of your great team? Like 2008, obviously, you can make the obvious symmetry of the fact that it was a Saracen semi-final, and who knows, it was Toulouse in that final as well. But I think going into that semi-final against Saracens in 2008, Munster had the least tries.
Are you a secret Munster or a secret Leinster fan owner?
We'll say nothing on that particular comment. I think going into that 08 semi-final,
Munster men from, you know, around Castle Island and those areas, Kerry's a proud tradition.
Well, absolutely there is. I'm sure that was all sarcasm from Ronan there.
Yes, I hope so.
the 2008 semi-final, just like going into that game, Munster had the best defensive record, I think, in the competition, least tries conceded of everybody less than the last four. Like, I do wonder if that was a part of your mentality that helped you win those tight games, win the games by small margins, knowing that if you had a kick to win the game, chances are it will be to win the game because you weren't going to concede too many more points.
Yeah, and I think it's so different, the mindset of kind of coaches, pundits, supporters. When we were in that dressing room, I'm sure the coaches were saying it to us, but we weren't even aware of what we had defensively or what we have offensively. We kind of knew what we wanted to do in a cup game, but like in terms of, like, lads, were the best defensive record, I don't think we were shouting that to ourselves in terms of this will really stand to us. It was kind of, well, someone would have been slagged anyway if Marcus came up with it, or Quinny decided to say it. There would have been someone that would just say it would have been made a joke of, you know. So I think there aren't any similarities on, because the game has so moved on in that 11 years.
Sure.
I think it would be a mistake of me to make any comparison. It's a completely new team, obviously. I think Earlsey is the link there with the older team, but from that regard, no, it's a completely different game and a different era with different, nearly, rules and how the game is played.
There's one last thing I just wanted to ask you about, Ronan, because there was an interesting piece in the Irish Examiner written by Simon Lewis last week. He was speaking with Gerry Flannery, and he was talking about his time spent down in New Zealand last year with the Crusaders and what he learnt and how he managed to apply it to Munster. And he's talking about the idea that you're always looking for answers in rugby, and you're always thinking what that crowd is doing, we should be doing, and we should be applying it to what we do because Crusaders are a brilliant outfit and all of that sort of thing. But he actually came to the realisation that what's right for Munster is what is right for Munster, that you guys might be doing something absolutely fantastic down in New Zealand, but ultimately it might not actually fit the style that Munster want to play or the identity of Munster rugby. What's your thoughts on that? I'm not sure how much you communicate with Gerry, but in terms of his rugby mindset, in terms of how he's managing to apply what he learned down there to Munster over the past few months.
Yeah, Gerry's a fascinating guy, a great guy with a hugely interesting brain, mind, philosophy on the game, and hugely driven. And yeah, I think he did come down. I think he probably got his world turned upside down. But also the fact that maybe I think he reinforced a lot of the good things that are in Munster. And I think that wasn't necessarily me telling them that. I think it was other coaches and other members of the staff down in the Crusaders. In fact, that I think it was kind of because the Crusaders, I think, suffered from it for a period of time, kind of looking over the fence to see what your neighbour has. So all the players that were playing in the All Black camp were coming back to Crusaders with ideas what was happening in the All Black camp. And then it took them a number of years, a large number of years, to actually say, we do things differently here and this is how we do it. And I think all of us suffer from it at certain stages when you look over the hedge and your man next door is driving a Beamer and you're driving a lad and you're kind of going, well, what's the story with that? But I think the point that the staff were making to Jerry was back, like, that everyone's identity is different and strengths are different. And you'd have to concentrate on that and build your game on your kind of, I suppose, your key components or your rocks of your environment. And I think, you know, I mean, Munster's DNA is well established at this stage about how they play the game, and there's no point changing their game to appease people who said they should be playing a wider game. Just stick what they're good at and get better at that, and then try and, I suppose, add on to the areas where they're not so strong. And I must look that article up. I didn't see that. So, you know, I think we all learn from each other in this game. And, you know, Jerry is incredibly passionate about it. And I think maybe another thing, probably the myth, is that more is more. Sometimes I think for the days or what he saw down here would be, in fact, sometimes less is more. And it's how you do it, in terms of you don't have to be doing 14 hours of analysis today and going into your meeting tired because you've done all your video work and you're annoyed at some of the players. Players are players. They don't have to do video work if they don't want to, but they have to perform well at the weekend, and every single one of them are different. So I think that's what makes the whole coaching ticket so exciting.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I made that point that ultimately it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, but at the same time, he says in the same article that Rob Penny, when he eventually came over to Munster, tried to transplant the Crusaders culture into the side, and there's still some of those things that are going on here. So you'd wonder if the two rugby cultures are that different at all.
I completely agree with you. They are very, very similar in some regard, I think. And they have great values in both clubs, and they're probably the two clubs I can speak pretty accurately about, having spent time in both. So, I think, but it's only when you get out you can kind of give an accurate comment on that. And that was the great thing for Jerry, I think, the fact that he's in Munster all his life and so passionate about it. But I think just to get out and to see how another club is doing it can either augment or diminish your approach to something. And I think he got good value out of it, which is what it's all about. We all need to grow.
Before you go, are you still involved in any horses, or are you waiting to come back to the Northern Hemisphere to get back involved?
No, he's lame. Paul Shanahan isn't looking after me. He's meant to be looking after me with one down in Joseph's, but
he's lame.
As you know, he's what would you say? He has an all groin injury.
Right.
Groin injury. So, Johnny, have a word with Paul Shanahan for me there and see what he's up to. But I've not texting Joseph, but he said, no, we'll need another few weeks. And then another few months go by. No, Raj, another few weeks.
He's playing you up steady. For like a kipper.
All is in hand. So, easy come, easy go. That's the name of the horse.
There we are.
We'll keep an eye out for it. When can we expect to see it make the track, or wherever it's going to take?
Could be 2 months or 3 years, the way he's talking there.
Yeah, Jesus, well.
Yeah, exactly. That's.
Was he named after you?
Easy come, easy go. We'll make sure to keep an ear out for it. Ronan, good stuff. We'll chat to you again.
You won that one, lads. Good luck.
A couple of comments in on the back of that piece. Jimmy McGee is asking, who is, or better yet, who isn't giving Rog a proper stream so he can watch Munster games without fail?
Yeah,
someone fix this immediately.
Yeah, obviously we shouldn't be advocating illegal streams, but where there's a will, there's a way, usually, you know.
He's right. There is nothing worse than knowing the outcome of a game and trying to watch it back afterwards in the sort of same light. Maybe it's better for cold analysis, knowing the outcome, or knowing that, or not being emotionally invested in something, but it just kills it as an event.
Oh, totally. I'd say
I'd say the best idea is to watch both, and you'll have a difference. You'll have quite a different view in hindsight than you did at the time. But talking about horses there, I hate like having a betting horse and not being able to watch the race, and it's a fairly common trait, and I'd much prefer watch it as live afterwards without knowing the results. If I know the result, I'm almost don't really care to watch it anymore. So it's that just beauty of not knowing, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Right, later tonight on Off the Ball, the lads have an interview with Sheffield United and RSGO David McGoldrick and Linda Stevens. They were chatting to Joe with thanks to EA Sports. Have a look at this.
Been told we have your FIFA ratings. Oh, there they are. So who comes out to 71-70? That's tight. End of thoughts?
I'm fuming.
That's a disgrace.
I think so as well. I'm chewing that. I think I'm miles off it.
David Myler was in the papers yesterday. Like he seems like he is the real deal, and he's almost going to be potentially like a full time e gamer. I'm not big on all this stuff, I have to be honest.
When he retires,
have you played Myler at FIFA down the years?
No,
someone has, hasn't it? Someone beat him.
Johnny Egan.
No, not Johnny Egan.
Yeah, Egan's beat him.
Page beat him as well.
He's lost a good few games.
Oh.
Yeah, he's not untouchable.
Okay, because you know the way it reads is he's literally untouchable. He's like world
pro
class.
Clubs, I think it's the pro clubs. If he has he has the best team on the thing, but I don't know about just a normal game.
Normal one-on-one game, I think Johnny Egan's beaten, H has beaten. I think Brownie's beaten a few times. Like he's lost a good few.
All right, well that changes everything. That's an absolute. Game changer. I thought this guy was literally unbeatable.
Yeah, good stuff there. That's coming up this evening on Off the Ball. You can check it out as well on youtube.com/offtheball if you want to watch the full piece a little bit later on.
Sheffield United on the cusp of, you know, the biggest kind of windfall in football where you get the Premier League, but one headphone set between the lads.
Yeah, £180 million game. Yeah,
so the first thing they're going to spend money on. Tom, how are you?
Good.
The right ear and the left ear, so it's not, but they went for both the same ear there, which made it a bit more cumbersome as well. Anyway,
they were all
around headphones.
Yeah, I've one headphone. I've one headphone, yeah. I brought my own. I'm better than the lads. Arsenal last night did the Champions League qualification hopes no harm. A 2-0 win for the Gunners over Newcastle put them third in the table. Ramsey and Lacazette got the goal, and the much maligned Mesut Ozil came in for praise from Unai Emery after the game.
You can't find the best performance for the team. And Mesut is also playing like we want, and with the system, with our tactical things, he's also working a lot. And after war, he's giving us his quality.
Republic of Ireland international Matt Doherty looks likely to return to the Wolves starting team later on this evening, having been on the bench for Saturday's defeat to Burnley. Wolves take on Manchester United in the Premier League tonight, of course, just over a fortnight after knocking them out of the cup. Should United gain revenge, and they'll jump Arsenal into third place. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer says his side will not change the attacking philosophy that's gotten them this far.
We've just got to go into the next seven games with the same attitude that we have done. We went into the games, nothing to lose. Let's go for it, see where it takes us. And now when we've got into this position, doesn't mean, or that means, just keep carrying on. Don't change your approach on how to attack games.
Meanwhile, Fulham's relegation from the Premier League could be confirmed tonight. Scott Parker's side in a miserable run of form. They've lost 12 of the last 13 games. They've lost the last 8 in a row, and they'll follow Huddersfield into the Championship if they lose away to Watford this evening. Last night, Premier Division leader Shamrock Rovers were dumped out of the EA Sports Cup. They went down on penalties 4-2 to First Division Bray Wanderers in that one. Elsewhere, Dundalk beat Pats 2-1 at Richmond Park. Bows had to come from behind to get the better of Cavan Teely 2-1 at Dalymount. Cork City got the better Neighbours Cove by 4-1 in that Cork derby. Waterford beat Galway United 2-1, and Finn Harps were 2-1 winners over Sligo after extra time.
I was down in Waterford.
Yeah,
actually.
Were you?
Monday night, League Cup, 450 people there. Interesting experience, yeah. Totally written off, nearly nicked a result down there as well. But there's a real good vibes down in Waterford at the moment, playing good football. I hadn't been down there in a few years. The stadium, the RSC, is in good nick.
Yeah.
I had a strange moment at the end where it was quite odd. So behind the stand, opposite the main stand, I'd never been there before, but there's a male jacks one end and there's a female toilet the other. So I went into the, I was going into the male toilet after the game, and in a very watered accent, around like, "We're locking up, you can use the male one." And I was like, "That is the male one." I was like, "Okay." So then I went down to use the female toilet, and there's something about League of Ireland female toilets, they're very clean.
Never used.
Very, very clean. It's like that Carlsberg ad where, you know, the phone has never rung before. It's like the complaints department. But then I just had this vision where I was going to get locked, because he'd locked up the male one, and he was going to lock up the female.
He's going to follow you down.
And I was going to like be live tweeting from the RSC being locked in the female toilet and trying to explain why I was there in the first place.
But by the sounds of things, they've done a fine job on it, so you could be locked into worst League of Ireland grounds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it wasn't the worst toilet to be locked into. You know, do you remember the Fyre Festival documentary where they were locked up into the airport overnight? Mm. This was a lot more comfortable for the...
What if
very
you know I did
time I was there.
Better than the Fyre Festival? Yeah. That should be the new tagline.
I'm looking forward to Netflix and Hulu documentary on your experience down there last night.
Yeah, League of Ireland female toilet. Discuss.
Yeah, that's not. Tonight, Shelburne House GCD at Talca Park in the EA Sports Cup, while defending champions Derry City take on Longford Town. Both of those games kick off at 7:45. And Bristol City and Middlesbrough's fierce battle for a place in the Sky Bet Championship playoff places continues when they meet at the Riverside. Tonight, they're level on points, and whichever side wins will go fifth in the league. Elsewhere, Swansea and Brentford, who are 9 points off the playoff positions with 8 games remaining. John Fogarty has confirmed he's held discussions with the IRFU about becoming Ireland's next scrum coach. He's reportedly incoming head coach as Andy Farrell's first choice to succeed Craig Feek after the World Cup. Fogarty's been working with the European champions since 2015, and he has admitted that joining an international setup is something that he would love to do. And in horse racing, Gordon Elliott could have as many as 13 runners in the Aintree Grand National on Saturday. A record. His mentor Martin Pipe held the previous record of 10 runners in 2001.
Can you name the one on the screen there?
Can I name
it's
that
a tough one?
That is definitely not Tiger Roll, though, the size of it. I say it's probably something like Shattered Lover.
Tiger Roll is only a tiny little horse.
He's an absolute pony.
Really? Yeah. He's a complete black swan. He's a total anomaly.
He trains, obviously, short price favourite Tiger Roll. He's going to become the first dual winner since Red Rum. And here's Gordon chatting about him now.
There's interviews going on every day. You start thinking about more, you know. I think if Tiger Roll done it, it'd be something special, because he's a horse that people have really latched onto, you know, for winning 4 times at Cheltenham and an English National. If he went and done it, I think it could end as one of the greats. The one worry I'd have is the 40 horses around you. You know, the best horse doesn't always win the Grand National, and that's the brilliant story to the Grand National.
Who are you tipping, lads?
Well, Davy Russell's going to ride Tiger Roll. It'll be a hell of an achievement, wouldn't it, to back it up. You just look at the weights now. He'll carry 11.5. Which is like third from top weight, which is just...
I've just gotten a follow from Vinnie Murphy on Twitter, the ex-Dublin legend, the iconic Vinnie Murphy.
Is he hoping for Grand National tips?
He is. Maybe he is.
That's the worst thing about being involved in horse racing, is the Grand National. The once a year
textures. It's the worst race. Literally the worst race I can think of to have a bet in, and you get people texting you. And
expecting you to give him the winner.
Yeah, myself and Dave James were talking about this last week. Neither of us has backed the winner of the Grand National yet. And between us, we're in our 70s, if you add our years together, or thereabouts anyway. Oh, that doesn't sound
good. It's kind of like your Cheltenham 2019, so. It's too soon, too soon.
It's way harsh. Well, all of the jockey bookings have been confirmed. David Russell.
Roland Nogara back on.
Yeah, get Roland.
I've got an answer to the horse question.
Okay.
Bless the wings.
Bless the wings. There you go. Davy Russell will ride Tiger Roll as he did last year. He's also revealed the jockey bookings for the rest of them. So Keith Donoghue will ride Outlander. Patrick Mullins will ride Don Poley. And a weird thing about Don Poley and Outlander, you can buy them Thursday before the race. They're both for sale.
Is this the Royal You now or really own?
Well, yeah. I don't know what owns Sari is, but
it's great with Tom in. You know, we can basically just talk racing for the morning.
New Olivier.
Having a clue what's going on.
In the Goff's entry sale on Thursday after racing, both Don Poley and Outlander will be auctioned. So you have a chance to buy a Grand National runner literally 2 days before the race. And like you hear Ronan talking about all that work that goes in, phoning trainers for 3 months in advance, hoping horses are literally there ready. You can just buy them on the day and then...
And how much would he pay for Don Poly, for example?
That's... Black Line cost 300,000, but like that was way over the
Don
top.
Don Poly's definitely on the wane. They're hard. It's probably a hard one to quantify in that if this horse were for sale 2 or 3 years ago, he would have gone for nearly a million. Yeah. Now he's going to go for...
I'd say he'll top 150 grand.
I'm not even sure he'd go for that, to be honest.
I don't know.
Jigginsound and Michael O'Leary have gotten a bit of criticism for this because they're selling Outlander and Don Poly, who, particularly Outlander... They have a lot of grade ones won, a lot of prize money won, but business is business, and I have no issue with it whatsoever.
Yeah, they have several hundred horses, and they effectively bankroll a lot of point-to-point level sales as well, where they go in and buy horses essentially 4 and 5 years old who have won one race in a field, essentially, and they pay in excess of €200,000 for a horse, for example. Like Samco was what, 335 grand, wasn't it?
300,
so,
yeah.
So, and that's kind of the going rate for point-to-pointers in the early stages of their career. So, you know, they buy all these horses, so they sell the ones that are on the wane. But huge opportunity. Anyway, the rest of the jockey buggings, Jack Kennedy will ride Dunacaz, Jamie Codd will ride Malabiche, Atua Phil will be on Dennis O'Regan, Robbie Parra will have Jury Duty, of course, he rode Silver Birch for Gordon Elliott in 2007, and Noble Endeavours, Mark Enright, Mom Magnatorious, Sean Bowen, Blow by Blow, Andrew Ring, General Principal JJ Slevin, Folsom Blue, Luke Dempsey and Robbie Dunn, Bless the Wings. An industry in itself, isn't it? Jockey bookings.
One last thing on that sale as well. The guy who makes the purchase for, if he buys Don Poli or Outlander, he knows that, like, on the way home from, you know, because it'll be quite well publicised, he knows afterwards a lot of people will be saying, you're a bloody idiot, they're gone at the game, the two horses. And there'll be an element of, there's a little risk involved here because my reputation is slightly, you know, on the line. If these turn out to be complete and utter flops, you know, it'll look like a stupid purchase. But you just could revive them as well. There is that gamble.
So I'm hearing that instead of putting your money on any horse in the betting for the Grand National, just go and buy Don Poli instead.
I mean, it's £1 million race now, so it's a completely different proposition to what it used to be.
Tom, thank you very much for popping into us this morning. So we're going to be talking football next, then Kevin Kilbane is on Off the Ball last night chatting about the effect that playing Henderson has on Klopp's side.
Thanks, Fabinho and Kate on the bench. Fabinho came on.
Yeah.
Henderson, Wijnaldum and Milner. He seems to be doubling down a bit in that partnership for the big games.
Yeah, he did that against Munich, didn't he? And I think Liverpool looked better as soon as Henderson went off. He went off very early in the game.
20 minutes in, Fabinho came on.
It just looked better to me. And
do you know why? Can you explain why?
Why he's doing it? I mean,
as in why it's better when Fabinho comes on.
Fabinho started to struggle. He started to struggle when he first played. When he first came into the side, he didn't play the first few games of the season, and we were thinking, why is he not playing this guy? Considering they paid so much money for him. Then he came in. He looked a bit sluggish, a bit slow on the pass. Mm. But he worked it out quite quickly. Then that I can't take that extra touch on the ball, and he moved the ball quicker. And I think he's. I wouldn't necessarily say he's more mobile than Henderson, but I think he's got the ability to pass forward quickly. I just think he's a better option than Henderson. Henderson's done very well for Liverpool, and he's the captain. When he's a captain, it's always difficult, I think, for a manager to leave a captain out of the side, no matter which side it is and what level that you're at. So he wants to stick with Henderson, but in my mind, the best option would always be Fabinho sitting. I think he's a better player. As bad as it may sound, Liverpool fans may not agree, but I think Fabinho's a better player than Henderson.
Yeah, that seems to be a debate that's raging on now for a bit longer than we expected at this point. Obviously, Jurgen Klopp isn't seeing in Fabinho what we're all seeing in Fabinho.
He just as Kev said there, he took time though, and you're at the stage of the season when you can't really be making risky decisions. And Henderson he's still a very solid performer. What you see is what you get. Club captain, he's a very inspirational figure. Carries that captain's responsibility. From the odd games I've gone to this season, you can see what it means to Henderson. After the Burnley game, he was 3 or 4 minutes going around clapping all the fans after the game, and His article in the Match programme was very much about the beauty of the club and imploring people to go to the Sean Cox fundraiser and lots of stuff. You know, Fabinho's probably a better footballer than him, but he's been a slow burner. He's definitely improved as the season has gone on, but it probably isn't the easiest decision. And you have that, just as Kev says, it's maybe elements of Seamus Coleman about this as well. If there's a debate about Seamus Coleman being captain is captain, and I think Klopp probably has massive time for Henderson in terms of that hunger that he brings to the pitch in a team that for a while maybe didn't have an awful lot of leaders or winners on it. Like, Henderson he's a great attitude, and for the next, what have we got, 6 or 7 games left, it's going to be very interesting to see how he goes.
Wolves against Manchester United tonight at 7:45. We touched on the top four race at the top of the show. How much of a disaster would it be for United to not win the Champions League and not make the top four? Is it even a disaster, given they've managed to get things back on an even keel somewhat with Solskjaer?
It's not a disaster, because when he got the job, it looked pretty unlikely that was going to happen. They needed to go on a run. Now, the flip side of that is they have the talent and the resources and the wage bill such that they should be, at the very least, competing for top four.
slight concern about how the season will end for them now, because Solskjaer has the job, and the narrative has changed a bit in that he knows now he's there, and the players know that he's there. Will that change? Just even though they don't realise it, will that change? Did Ireland's rugby season change a bit when the succession was confirmed and Joe Schmidt, they knew that he was gone at the end of the year? I don't know, but I think managerial kind of things in the background can have an effect on players. And funny enough, when they played Wolves in the Cup, it was coming after, I'm pretty sure it was the Saturday after the second leg against PSG, and they were absolutely atrocious in that game. So we'll see how they will be tonight. Not actually playing that well. Didn't play that well on Saturday at the moment. I think this is very tough. I see the betting. Wolves are 3-1, Man United are even money. I can't see. That makes no sense to me. Like, what do Wolves have to do to be recognised as a good team that they are, with home advantage? I think they have a big chance of beating Man United tonight. I'm just not sure. Will things change a little bit with Solskjaer having gotten the job? But forget about the Champions League, really. They need to get top four, and after that, it's a very successful season for them. It's top four is where it's at.
Once that turned around from Saturday against Watford, the goals from Rashford and Martial have both taken them to 10 in the league this season. So they joined Lukaku and Pogba on double digits for this season. Now, this is the first time that's happened with four players in double digits since the 95-96 season, and it was Scholes, Cantona, Giggs and Andy Cole who did it for them on that occasion. Like, you can say it as, well, you know, Lukaku had a desperate start to the season, was poor, so they've had to get goals from all different areas, and number 9 wasn't doing the business for them. Or you could say Solskjaer has stumbled upon an attack that has threats in every single area, and giving him a full season now next year allows him to become one of the more terrifying attacks in the Premier League.
Oh, 100%, and that's the whole thing about Manchester City as well. If you're setting up defensively and you know that on the break you have four players that are hitting double figures in a season, and I mean, Lukaku could easily hit 20 goals if he was playing regularly. He'd certainly steamroll the flat track bully against the weaker teams. It's very hard to defend against that. And I suppose, looking at the League of Ireland this season, that's the one thing about Shamrock Rovers. You're like, are they really going to score enough goals? Do they have enough goals from other areas? Whereas Dundalk do have a lot of attacking players that can score goals, and Man United can certainly. I still think Solskjaer doesn't exactly know what his best kind of system is, and he deserves time to have that. But on the break, they're frightening prospects. And that first goal on Saturday, the beautiful simplicity of the ball from Shaw, stuff like that, that's going back to base there, where you have basically players that are able to attack at pace. And It's a lovely thing to look forward to next season, to have those four players as options and to be able to mix it up as well.
Like, what's your kind of sense on how this top four is going to finish? It seems at this point that Chelsea are the team that everybody's saying, well, they're going to finish sixth. They're up against Brighton tomorrow night at 7:45, and I wonder, in sort of a very weird way, the mutiny has gone on for so long at this point that they've actually just got used to being completely screwed. It seems that Sarri was a dead man walking a long, long time ago, and he's still there. I don't know how he's managed to survive, and I wonder if they're just going to absolutely bear the brunt of this and see the season out with a manager who doesn't want to be there because the players hate him, and vice versa, and they'll actually just get on with it and put together some sort of purple patch.
Yeah, I don't know if the players hate him as well. I think there's it's probably a bit of player power as well. Back in the day, you might question your manager, but you perform for him. The problem with them is they have played 31 games. Arsenal going into it. It's kind of like the playoffs in England, where the team that finishes third should beat the team that finishes sixth, but generally doesn't, because of the psychology of not being in the top two and the sixth place team scraping into sixth and thinking this is great. And you just wonder with Spurs, the form they're in, and like, where is this going with them? I honestly don't know how to call it. I would have grave reservations about Spurs. Are they going to limp over the line? I think their form is so bad that they definitely could slip. The Chelsea situation is a mystery to me. I don't know what's going on with Hazard. Will they help and get Sarri, you know, over the line? I honestly don't know.
You've got to be worried about Arsenal as well, which seems a strange thing to say given their current form, but you look at their away fixtures that are left, and they don't play any of the big six, but really it's Wolves, Watford, Burnley, Leicester and Everton all on the road. Everton this weekend is first up. I mean, every single one of those fixtures, from an Arsenal perspective, you're looking at banana skin, banana skin, banana skin.
Yeah, and I think Dan McDonald has an article in the Argentina today saying that Chelsea, like, have a kind of a really
sort of doable out in terms of the Champions League in the Europa League, and they may put their eggs in that basket. Arsenal haven't been all that convincing. Last night's win was massive. I know they completely dominated the game and Newcastle probably offered nothing really going forward. I wouldn't trust them on the road, though. I wouldn't really trust them. I know they've... I don't know. I probably have more faith in Man United getting Solskjaer over the line than the other three.
They're the only team at the moment in that top four race that you can say that you don't not trust. As in, you trust them a little bit, Manchester United. But with Arsenal, with Chelsea, with Spurs, you're like...
But yeah, they all have doubts on. Manchester United have... Now, the Solskjaer has gotten the job. Would you be confident of Manchester United beating Wolves tonight or even playing that well?
I'd be more confident than any of the other three.
Yeah, probably. It's strange that you have so many doubts about four teams going for two massive positions at this stage of the season, four of the best teams. And still doubts about Liverpool as well, I think. And to an extent, Man City, but certainly Liverpool.
Yeah, it's been great. Like, the chasm is ever growing between the top six and the rest, they say. But, I mean, you look at these fixtures and you're thinking there's just as good a chance when the mid-table teams host any of these top six for taking points off them.
Yeah, like, looking at Liverpool as well, their fixtures... There are a couple of games they have where I know they've gotten the top teams out of the way now, but a couple of their fixtures, you're like, I'm not sure I'd trust them to win there. And it's going to be a really, really interesting end of the season. Probably the relegation thing looks a bit sorted now. Cardiff don't think they have it in them to win. They've tough fixtures as well left. But it's really fascinating at the top. And the only thing I think will happen, I think Liverpool have blown it. But other than that, I couldn't really predict anything.
Right, just to finish up on football, we had Brian Kerr on commentary duty at Liverpool 2, Spurs 1 at the weekend, and we couldn't let him go without getting his take on Ireland's first couple of wins under Mick McCarthy.
Just before we let you go, first time to talk to you since the Mick McCarthy era part 2 began for Ireland. Were you as energised and refreshed by the Irish performance against Georgia as everybody else was?
Well, I thought they played very well. Let's be honest, it didn't take much for it to be better than it was over the last 2 years. I mean, I've said it over and over again, the football was atrocious. There was nothing about it to enthuse. There was no pattern to play. Players didn't seem to have any direction. That went out the window. You could see, I mean, Gibraltar match was a messy match all around, but the second match with Georgia, you could see the players were attempting to obey orders. There was a clarity about how they were going to press, what the triggers were. If McGoldrick made the first move, players were up behind him, putting pressure on the opposition, forcing them to kick the ball long, and then we were getting players into the box on the end of crosses. And there was football too. There was a mixture in the game. I saw the ball getting thrown out of the back now and again. Glenn Whelan gave stability in front of the centre halves, let the full backs get up into the play. Enda Stevens had probably his best game. Hourihan, for me, had his best game yet in Irish jersey. We saw a bit more of Hendrick. I thought Brady did all right on the right hand side. Seamus Coleman was very, very good, and McGoldrick was the big plus. Centre halves were brave and made good blocks when it was appropriate. But I think Hendrick or Brady are better when a manager tells them what they've got to do. There's your job, this is where you have to run, this is how I want you to close down. When we have the ball, this is the position I'd like you in. I think with that type of instruction, those players may get back to the form they showed going back to the tournament in France at the Euros. But it was a performance that gave you a bit of hope that we could pull out results against Denmark and Switzerland, and I think at this stage that's not bad.
Yeah. Brian Kerr there reacting to Liverpool's win against Spurs at the weekend in dramatic circumstances, and of course talking about Mick McCarthy's first couple of games with Ireland. Delighted to say now that George Dockrell, Ireland cricketer, is with me in studio. How are things?
All good, thanks.
We're just having a bit of a Rathgar love in there. I was just watching yourself and Johnny talk about the local haunts, your favourite places in the district.
The Gar, as it's otherwise known. Yeah, what was it like growing up in Rathgar?
Yeah, it's a nice spot. Lovely place. It was close to all where I was used to go to school, and all my sports clubs and everything was really, really close around there. So, yeah, pretty nice place to...
Were you high school?
I was Gonzaga, actually.
Okay, yeah.
So not far away.
Rathgar would kind of have a reputation for being, like, you know, one of those kind of, you know, very nice Southside areas. With my experience of it, the people are very, very friendly. And actually, kind of...
they're not like up their own asses at all. I really find it a nice place. I'd live there at a heartbeat, George.
Oh, it's a heartbeat. Spot.
Can't afford it though at the moment.
John Clooney was talking at the weekend about going to Gonzaga. You were a couple of years behind him, and he was speaking about being a pretty talented soccer player as a youngster, managed to get onto the rugby team at Gonzaga at the time because it wasn't a great rugby team there at the time, and that's how his rugby career springboarded. And ultimately, there was this very sporty guy playing loads of different things who ended up settling on a professional sport. So I'm not sure, is there anything you can kind of relate to on that sense?
Yeah, I remember John, he was at my primary school as well, and obviously at Gonzaga the year ahead of me, so he was incredibly talented athlete the whole way growing up. He was, you know, always the fastest, best at football, best at kind of any sport he played, so he obviously had that basis in it. And I'd say same with all sports. I think if you look at any of the athletes now, they tend to have that grounding in a number of different sports.
Did you play anything else other than cricket?
Yeah, I played rugby, football, hockey and cricket all up till I was probably 15, and I think that was probably pretty important for me. I know, speaking to a lot of coaches about cricket, they kind of say the best athletes or the best movers are guys who read the game, have played another sport. A lot of the times, obviously, something like a field sport, like football or rugby or hockey or whatever it is, I think it does give you a great kind of spatial awareness and learning in that sense. So I'd always say it's so important to keep playing as many sports as you can growing up, and definitely adds to you when you're older.
Is that a sense across all the Ireland team that they've played different sports growing up?
I think a lot of the guys would have played a number of sports. You know, cricket's a summer sport, but a lot of the time then you have something in the winter, whether it be hockey, which is quite similar, or anything else. You know, all the lads, we play football every morning in warm-ups, and it's almost more professional than our cricket at times.
What's the best football there?
We're all pretty bad, which is worrying, but it's not for lack of trying. Like, there's times they've had to call the game off because things get a little bit too heated.
Doc will Slade's teammate himself.
Yeah, no, I'll keep that for on the pitch. But no, I think a lot of the guys have a good grounding in a number of different sports, and I think that's what kind of creates good athletes. Because again, I think you learn a lot of different things from different sports.
Is that distinctly Irish? Or like, say, when you were over in Somerset, did you feel that your teammates were specialised very early in life? Or was it kind of similar to what you are now?
Some of the guys were. I think the biggest learning I had, I remember I was over in Australia training with Queensland a few years ago and talking to their S&C, and he said the guys he wanted and the guys he had in the system who he felt were, you know, top class athletes, and again the way they moved and was all the guys who had played sport to a high level that wasn't cricket. And he kind of talked about how he didn't like when young cricketers at, you know, 13, 14, 15 in Australia started just committing to that, and I think it is pretty important, I think, to keep reminding kids and people that a lot of the time, sometimes you also bloom late. You don't know what you're going to be good at. My story, I thought, was quite interesting. I was a left-arm seamer, fast bowler, up until I was, I think, 13 or 14. And then a coach finally told me, look, you're not really going to make it like that. Maybe you should try bowling spin. And then 2 years later, I was playing for Ireland A. So again, it was something that if I'd stuck about being a, you know, seam bowling batter, I don't think I would have ever played for Ireland.
How was your spin at that stage before you were sort of transformed into being that?
It was pretty average, but yeah. I think I was in a car park in Wales at an underage tournament, and a coach saw me messing around playing a bit of tennis ball, cricket, and he just said,
"This could be like the movie. It's like, oh, this is the scene where it's like, oh no,
the
no
moment."
No.
And it is amazing. He just said to me the next day, he said, "Look, no, no disrespect, but I think maybe there's an option for you to bowl spin this week and see how it goes." And I'm left-handed, so left-arm spin is quite a dangerous thing, and it's quite unique. There's not as many left-arm spinners out there, and I did it that week. Things went well, and as I said, within 2-3 years I was playing for Ireland A, and then I think 4 years later I was playing for the national team. So again, it was an amazing moment, and again, if you hadn't have done that, I'm not sure I would have ever been playing. Exactly, yeah. Wouldn't be here.
Drinking in Rathgara.
Not a bad alternative.
No, not a bad option.
Like, it must be a weird sensation actually being told that at the time, because you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know that this is going to result in a massively positive arc in your career. At the time, you must be thinking, I'm pretty good. I've actually got to this level already. I'm down in Australia and all that. I've done all right so far. Should I really trust what this guy is saying to me?
Yeah, it was interesting. And I'd bowled for, I think, Ireland under-13s the year before, and I'd, you know, got a couple of wickets. So again, would have thought I was relatively successful at that stage. But yeah, it was Brian O'Rourke who was the coach, and he was fantastic. I suppose the way he delivered it to me and convinced me, and I did it that week, and it went so well that I kind of felt like, look, this is something worth pursuing and worth working at. And I'm very, very glad I did, and thankfully as well, at no point anyone really questioned that either. I'm sure maybe my parents or some of my coaches back home were thinking, you know, a week later when I came back, saying, you know, are you now a spinner, or like, how did that happen? But again, I just kind of committed to it fully, and again, within a year or two, things came together and went well.
Does spin bowling evolve much in terms of the years you're playing, guys trying to outdo each other? Because
because it obviously is such a unique skill?
Yeah, a lot. I think even spinning itself is changing a lot now within world cricket. You know, you always have
rules are sort of.
No, I just mean in how guys get an edge and how the game develops. You know, nowadays with T20 cricket, I think it's getting harder and harder to be an off spinner. You know, a finger spinner. You know, unless you're a wrist spinner, a leg spinner, like the likes of Shane Warne and all those guys who obviously get a lot more turn on the ball. It's getting tougher and tougher now to not get hit out of the park with how good guys are getting at T20 cricket and you know with the bats and the good pitches these days and how far they can hit the ball. So it's definitely interesting. The skills are changing a little bit and you just have to try and adapt the whole time and keep moving with it.
It's interesting that you talk about that adaption because there's also kind of a more modern-based adaptation that you've made, which is like getting a bat in hand a little bit more often than you have done initially. Does that give you a greater understanding of the other side of the ball as well?
Yeah, definitely. I think you got to learn from all aspects. Got to try and get better the whole time. Again, when I came into the team, I think I could have held a spot in the national team with my bowling alone. And as the years and years go on, you know, the younger cricketers who come out now, they can all bat, they can bowl, they can field. So that you can't really have an area that you're not strong at. And that's something that I kind of felt that I needed to really, really work on and get my batting to a place where I can contribute with the bat and I can try and win games with the bat as well. You know, it's not a finished product. It's something that I'm going to have to keep working on the whole time. But yeah, my thoughts in the last number of years has just been that I need to be a brilliant fielder, a brilliant batter, and a brilliant bowler to try and contribute in one game. And you know, being good at one or two skills probably isn't good enough these days.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess the conflict you constantly have is that there's only just a limited amount of training time. Like when you go into what is probably one of the biggest summers in the history of Irish cricket this year, playing against some of the best teams in the world, are you trying to make yourself the perfect form of what you're already good at, or are you trying to just get good at everything? Because I know there's only so far you can get in all these different areas of cricket.
Yeah, I think you know there is always limited time, but I think you just got to try and get a little bit better every day at all three skills. It is tough, I think, when you have a full day's training, but again, I think there's enough time there to just chip away a little bit, get a little bit better every single day, and I think that always adds up year on year.
Is it more one-on-one training you're doing on the batting element of things?
Yeah, no, I've been working quite well with Graham Ford and Ed Joyce and a number of the different coaches within the Irish setup. But a lot of it's also just been mental, I think. Just kind of thinking about what my game was and where it was and where I wanted it to go and just giving it some real thought. And I think a lot of it, that mental side, is what's actually given me more help than actually getting the nets and putting into place the stuff I've decided to work on. But yeah, I think it was just more, you know, sitting down and really rethinking about what I wanted to do with my game.
What are you thinking about?
Well, I suppose in specific terms, you know, I kind of looked at my strengths and my weaknesses, and I think I've been a bit, you know, stuck on consistently working on my strengths. And I looked at basically where I was weak, the areas I wasn't hitting the ball, and I decided to work on those shots. So for me, it was improving my leg side game and making sure that I could get the ball to the leg side as well as the offside. And for me, that's just been quite a simple change, but it's just seemed to have worked.
How have you rated 2019 so far? Obviously, it's a huge year coming up on a cricket sense. Like, I think you've got your 200th cap for Ireland now, the second youngest player to do it. It came in the loss to Afghanistan, so I presume that was a fairly bittersweet moment.
It was, yeah. I was so excited for that day, and it was an amazing moment to have got that cap, and absolutely delighted to have got to that point. Never really thought that would happen, especially not when I was bowling seam at 13. And yeah, it was obviously gutting to have lost that game, and instantly that moment was gone, and it didn't really matter to me, if you know what I mean. It took the shine off that a little bit, but then, you know, we won the next game the next day, and I remember we were sitting in the change room after the game, and me and Paul Sterling were saying how good a feeling, you know, that win was, and how 201 caps was actually the good number to have got to, and that was a special day for us. So I'm just delighted to have got to that point, and more importantly, I think getting the win the next day, drawing that series with Afghanistan, you know, in their conditions, was probably a bigger moment.
Yeah, the irony is we've been speaking about early specialisation here and how perhaps it can happen way too soon in a person's life, and there might be a bit too much of a focus on it. And you're sitting here, the second youngest player to reach 200 caps for Ireland. Like, it was a fairly meteoric rise at a young age, or things happened very young for you, capped as a teenager, going over to England quite soon. Like, in hindsight, is that something that you're so happy for, that it would all happened so quickly for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I spoke about this recently. I think it made things a lot easier for me coming into the team at 17. I think there was no pressure on me whatsoever. You know, I couldn't really do anything wrong. And my first year, again, that was my attitude towards it. And after my first year, I think I had about 30 or 40 caps and 40 or 50 wickets for Ireland. And suddenly I felt settled at 18 in a team, which is so lucky. I know a lot of guys might come in and get their opportunity, you know, when they're 20 or mid-20s. And there's probably a little bit more pressure on them then because they're more aware of the situation. Whereas I was almost, as I said, in a place where I knew I had nothing to lose. You know, 17 years old, nothing could go wrong. You know, I wasn't expected to perform, and things just went so well. It meant that, you know, I had a lovely 2 or 3 years up to the age of 20 or so, where I was just able to kind of feel my way into the international sport, and again, felt like there was absolutely no pressure on it.
Is it true that your leaving cert clashed with the World Cup in 2010?
It was interesting. I was in the Caribbean at the World Cup the month before my leaving cert, so I got back and I did 2 or 3 weeks work. Somehow managed to pass and get the points I needed. So I'd always say, if anyone wants to know good leaving cert prep, definitely go to the Caribbean, Barbados for a few weeks. So I got into science at Trinity, and I actually missed a game against Australia to do my biology exam. That was the problem. But I've now since started a data science degree in DCU, which I'm doing at the moment. So that's keep me very busy in between the cricket whenever a little bit of free time.
Because you went to Trinity initially, and then Somerset happened, so you parked that, understandably, to pursue life over in England. Like, that balance between education and professional sport is such a tricky thing to come up with. How tough was that decision to actually say, I'm going to park this for a while and just pursue professional sport only?
It seemed easy enough at the time. I started the science degree, then went over to Somerset and wasn't expecting to play as much first team cricket at the age of 18, but my first year was straight into the team. Did really, really well and felt like it was an opportunity. I, you know, couldn't give up and couldn't possibly, you know, go away from that to do my first year exams. So decided to defer the exams, did them another year, and you know, it seemed quite an obvious choice at the time that if I was playing first team cricket that it was an opportunity I couldn't miss, and deferred for a number of years, and then only this year I've decided to go back into DCU now to do data science, which is something I'm a little bit more passionate about, I think, and really, really excited, and I've loved every bit so far. It's tough with the cricket, but a lot of the time, you know, we train maybe 3 or 4 hours a day, and there still is time, you know, in and around that before the session, late at night, to try and get stuff done that you need to do. So I really, really enjoy it, and I actually find, again, the data science really, really helps my cricket, takes the pressure off at times and gives me another avenue to kind of focus on and concentrate on, and it's nice having those two things that are so different and so separate but that you can put your energy into.
Yeah, I found that with players and the professional footballers as well, and there was a piece with David Crawley who was at Man City, and then I think Brian Horton took over. There was a managerial change, and a lot of times managers came in and basically you were out of favour straight away, but the amount of players I've spoken to who've taken up coaching part-time and just that release to do something different, not to be thinking focus on training, football, and to be able to do something different, I think it's probably one of the things about professionalism that is maybe a negative, that you're not actually doing anything else. I genuinely think that you're a lot better to spice up your life a bit, just do different things.
Definitely, I think there's some very interesting people when you talk to back in the day when even sport, you know, wasn't at that professional level, and you talk about guys playing, you know, international rugby matches or football matches and then heading back on a Monday to work, and obviously there was some negatives that they probably couldn't train to the full ability and give it the full you know, full level of concentration that they would have liked, but at the same time I do think it does give you a little bit of you know, leeway with the two, and for me I quite like that. You know, there's probably not many people who've gone and played a test match and gone home and done some calculus like I had to do out in India, but at times when it's been a bad day or a lot of the time with, you know, pressure of professional sport, every single time you play you're being judged, you're being rated on how it goes, so sometimes it is nice to just have something where you go away and you put your focus into something else and just kind of get a little bit of a
escape. Yourself at 40 then, would you be in cricket or?
So I would love to take the data science and actually go into sport again. I'd love to kind of combine that knowledge and my knowledge of professional sport and go into a level of kind of analysis within you know, with a sporting organisation or with another company. So yeah, I think it's something I would love to get to a point where I have that done by the time I finish cricket and then
marry the two.
And can go back into that area.
I presume it's a fairly huge focus in terms of being in a test team is the data science and the amount of information you're processing. Have you started asking questions like that as to how you're coming up with this information? Because obviously, on, from their perspective, it's make this thing as simple as possible for the players to consume, whereas you think very, very differently to most cricket players.
Yeah, no, I am very interested in how you get to that point as well. And I think I'm always very interested in how you can gain information from that data, from that huge set that we have. So, you know, our analyst, Scott Irvine, talked to him quite a bit about what he does and what information he gets and how he gets it. And also just thinking myself, you know, is there any way this can be done, you know, a different way, or you know, how else can we gain insights from the information we have or the information that is available?
How does he take that questioning?
I think he takes it pretty well. Obviously, I think he's probably quite interested in that area too, so that's why I quite like picking his brains, and hopefully vice versa. He probably doesn't enjoy the chat as much as I do, but I think it is just nice chatting to him about those kind of things, and again, learning from my point of view, and seeing, again, ultimate goal is try and get a little bit of an insight that might help me on the pitch, and I'm quite analytical thinking anyway in that sense. But if I feel like I have an edge over a batter when I'm bowling to him, or over a bowler when he's bowling to me, I feel pretty good about that. So I think it's something that I like to have kind of in my armory when you're going onto the park.
So it's a pretty big couple of months coming up. Ireland, England, ODI in Malahide. That's on the 3rd of May. You can get tickets now on Ticketmaster if you want to watch the lads at home. But then the big one, really, it's hard to not talk about Lords in the middle of July. Like, how excited are you for that? I can already see it's such an unusual feeling for us. I can already picture the scenes out in the office watching Test cricket from an Irish perspective against England. Like, we've already had two of them so far.
Brexit have gone through by then.
Well, yeah, that's actually a good point.
Yeah, we're supposed to have, so it'd be interesting.
Dockrell on Brexit.
Yeah, like, is that something that's already in your consciousness? Like we mentioned that, like, you've got the Tri series coming up before that, you've got an ODI against Afghanistan before that. There's a lot of stuff to get through before that England test in Lords, but you're probably thinking about it as sort of the end point of this year, as the biggest event of the year, or am I completely mistaken there?
Oh, look, it is a massive, massive game. You know, Lords is the home of cricket. It's such a special place. We played there 2 summers ago in an ODI, and again, the Irish crowd that were there were fantastic. The atmosphere was incredible. It's very unique in a stadium, and the kind of the whole buzz you get around the place, it is just special.
A lot of expats like as well would love to go, I guess, that live in England. And
definitely, and there's such great support over in London, so it will be an amazing game. Obviously, it's such a special place, and you know, what greater chance to go over and try and beat England at Lords. You can't ask for much more. And again, something growing up, and even when I was probably 16, 17, the thought of me being able to play a test match against England and of Ireland playing a test match against England, you know, at this stage of Irish cricket is amazing. And again, it's probably, again, a tribute to everyone who's put in the effort they have over the last number of years that we've got to this stage.
Yeah,
do you ever consider the Owen Morgan route of going over there and potentially playing for England in that for your career? Or?
I think when Owen did it, it was a little bit of a different situation. You know, Irish cricket hadn't quite got to the point it is now. I was so lucky. I came straight out of school. Obviously, I did my leaving cert, and I was straight onto a contract, and I was able to play professional cricket, you know, full time. So I suppose it wasn't something that I needed to do the way he did.
Mm. So you can stay at home, really, and like make it in cricket a lot more than you could 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. And even since I've come into the team now, you know, there's contracts there for the guys, there's developmental contracts too, there's some fantastic support. We've got more and more guys at home with the domestic structure here as well. So, you know, in terms of setup now, it's so far from where it was, and credit to everyone within Cricket Ireland and to have got it to that point. And, you know, now for a young Irish cricketer, there is the systems, there is the setup, and there is the support here to succeed.
And like playing England and potentially beating England in Lords, can you imagine just a curious kid at home watching that and what that might do to him?
Hmm. Yeah, and it would be incredible. I was so lucky. I was at school during the 2007 World Cup, and I saw the impact beating Pakistan had. But suddenly, you know, Gonzaga, it used to be football or rugby at lunchtime, and suddenly people were playing cricket. You know what I mean? The 4 or 5 different games of cricket going on the front green, and I'd never seen that before. And so it's so easy to see how easy, you know, kids get inspired from 1 or 2 games. Again, we saw last summer with the women's hockey how much that can help the sport in the country. So again, it's 1 or 2 moments like that can inspire a whole generation, and obviously that's what we, you know, try and work towards.
I remember playing cricket with a friend of mine in his farm in Kerry. It was just like one massive, the cows weren't in the field that day, so we went out and the two of us played cricket for a couple of hours. It was just the two of us. It was kind of, we should have called a few more people around. This is actually a picture from Tralee cricket ground down there. That's one hell of a setting, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely beautiful down there. It's an incredible place. I haven't got down yet. I think we keep saying there's going to be a tour match down there at some point. But yeah, no, it's an incredible spot to play a bit of cricket. And there's plenty of beautiful grounds like that around Ireland.
What's the relationship as well? Because obviously cricket is all Ireland, and you've a lot of guys from Northern Ireland obviously playing for Ireland because it's quite strong up there. And how have you all bonded over the years? I know that it's kind of one of my bugbears that the IFA and the FAI were separated at partition. But what's it like playing cricket for Ireland in that regard?
Yeah, I'm just so used to it again. Mm. You know, from 12, 13, I was training with those guys. I've got friends from Belfast, from Derry, ever since I was 12 or 13. So it's for me, it doesn't really seem like there's
not
anything. Not a thing. It doesn't really seem. Obviously, I think that's the thing about sports. Sport doesn't really anyway, create those separations. So yeah.
George, very best of luck with the next couple of months. Thanks million for popping in. George Dockrell there of Ireland Cricket. Right, so we're going to be turning to something a little bit different here next on OTBAM. Here's a clip from Off the Ball special WrestleMania preview discussing the meteoric rise of Ireland's Becky Lynch.
Is it all down to her own force of will? Is it all down to her putting herself over? Factor in a way that we
would. Yeah, they would have had to, because as we've seen before, people like Zack Ryder, people who purely go out on their own and try and get themselves over and try and get themselves a groundswell of popularity, that works to a degree, but ultimately, Vince or the office are going to be pissed off that these people have gone out and done it without their say-so and without their fingerprints being all over. There are some Vince fingerprints on this. There are some Triple H fingerprints on this. She clearly went to them with an idea, going, listen, I'm spinning my wheels at the minute. How about we try this? You let me go and run my mouth to a degree. You can kind of point me in the direction of what you want me to say, and we'll see how that takes off. And luckily for her, it has.
I think it's funny, actually, back in the day that they pointed out that they absolutely hated her accent back in the day. And now it's one of the big things that got her over. Mm. You know, that Dublin accent just shines when you're spitting trash on a microphone. It's absolutely fantastic. My bogger accent just can't compete when I'm running my mouth.
But people still fear the big red wrecking ball. What did she say in her own words? Let's have a look at the tweet that she put up after the WWE made the announcement that she will be the main eventer. And I think she basically said, I deserve it, is to paraphrase it. An incredible graphic. Hard to believe that the biggest female star on the planet at the moment is Ronda Rousey in terms of any kind of athletic pursuit. But Becky Lynch is in that match and is probably where all, Richie, you made the point, probably where all the eyeballs are on. She is the dominant persona in that match, which 18 months ago, 2 years ago, few could have believed that she would be the one we're all wanting to see in that.
And especially given the fanfare that Rousey came in with just over a year ago, everybody would have presumed that she was going to run roughshod over the roster. And by the time WrestleMania comes around, she'd basically have a crowning achievement. She'd wander off into the sunset and do what she wants to do for a year and come back whenever she pleases then in a kind of Batista role. But she's been put in a happy place.
Will O'Callaghan is here on the back of that clip. How are you, Will?
More known, how are things?
So there's another Off the Ball wrestling special coming next Monday on the back of WrestleMania, and it's pretty exciting times from Becky Lynch's perspective.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, the MetLife Stadium this coming Sunday, 82,500 capacity at the stadium. WWE have kind of filled it out before. We're always a little bit suspicious about their attendance figures. They have been known to inflate them in the past. But Becky Lynch in the first ever all-women's main event of WrestleMania for WrestleMania 36. And what's interesting in this one as well is that she's the first foreign non-Canadian or American to be in the main event of WrestleMania since Andre the Giant. So that maybe puts it into perspective how big a deal it is. She's going to be up against Ronda Rousey, who's the crossover star from MMA, and Charlotte Flair, the daughter of Ric Flair, the former 18-time world champion. So it's a huge night for Becky Lynch, and she's come a long way up the industry in a pretty quick period of time.
Like, just purely, I'd be very ignorant in the subject, but just scrolling through Instagram and following them all on Instagram, her shtick at the moment seems to be the fact that I've worked for this harder than my other two opponents. Is that true?
Well, she's quite literally changed her Twitter profile to The Man. Mm. And that has been her character really for the last year or so. She was in a fairly aimless place, as you probably heard in the clip there, that she was down the card kind of going into last summer. Last WrestleMania, she was a long way away from the main event. And then, remarkably, she's become the most popular star in WWE. They've changed their scope towards women's wrestling. That's probably key here as well. Once upon a time, the women in wrestling were purely the object of lust from their fans. And now there's kind of far more recognition of the athletic ability of the women going into this. And you've got three wrestlers who probably would stand up against any of the male athletes that they have. But from a purely character point of view, Becky Lynch, who's been running her mouth, running roughshod through the entire roster in terms of the women, she has become the top character. And interestingly, the top merchandise seller as well. We have had Irish wrestlers at the top before, like Sheamus, who was a former WWE champion. Even Finn Balor, who was a Universal champion a few years ago, who trained Becky Lynch. She has become probably more popular than they were when they were at the top of the ladder before.
What's been the reason behind that attitude change? Is it like Stephanie McMahon's growing role? She was like, this is pretty bad how women are actually depicted in WWE, and we're actually going to change it towards exactly what the UFC does with their women fighters as well.
Yeah, I think Becky Lynch once upon a time was part of the so-called Four Horsewomen in NXT, which is their developmental brand, right. And they took wrestling a bit more serious for the women through NXT. Those four came up together to big success, and herself and Charlotte Flair have had this kind of interesting dynamic where they've been friends and sometimes rivals, and last year they started kind of the acorns of the seed really going into this WrestleMania, where there was a dispute between Becky Lynch and Charlotte, where Charlotte was getting the chances that Becky wasn't, and that's the story they're trying to tell going into this. As things have changed even since we recorded that podcast, the two women's belts for either brand, Raw and SmackDown, which people might be familiar with, are now both on the line as of last night for this main event as well. Ronda Rousey carries in the Raw title, Charlotte Flair carrying in the SmackDown title, and Becky Lynch, as many people will expect this weekend, will win both, because you usually get a happy ending
on in
WrestleMania. Yeah.
You've been to WrestleMania 2002?
Went to WrestleMania 18. Yeah, it was The Rock and Hulk Hogan, which was not the main event, but it probably upstaged a pretty poor main event between Chris Jericho and Triple H. It was around the time that Triple H was the dominant guy after his comeback. But Rock Hogan was absolutely incredible. It was in Sky Dome Toronto.
That's a pretty great show. Like, is that up there in terms of the best sporting events you've been to?
Yeah, I'm sure there's plenty of people who are watching us at the moment. They're probably saying this is not a sporting event. You have to use, you know, inverted commas when you say sporting event. But in terms of atmosphere, in terms of enjoyment, I was a big fan of the product back then. It was just off the back of the Attitude Era, where anyone who's growing up at that age is probably thinking, hey, you know, I'm really big into this. And then I definitely drifted away from the sport for a long time. And then maybe just the emergence of some of the Irish talents like Sheamus, Finn Balor, now Becky Lynch, has got me back into wrestling again. And while WrestleMania X8 might be remembered as the best WrestleMania, it had to follow the best ever the year before.
Was that the Hell in a Cell?
No, it wasn't Hell in a Cell. No, X7 was The Rock against Austin.
Right.
The wrestling has probably never been any hotter than it was. It was the first wrestling pay-per-view to ever sell more than 1 million pay-per-view buys, which maybe puts things into context to how popular it was then. It's nowhere near as popular now, but Becky Lynch is the big star in the industry currently.
Yeah, for sure. So you can head on over to youtube.com/offtheball if you want more of that. Just a couple of other stories we wanted to touch on, because you've been watching the snooker this morning. Ken Doherty is having a very good morning.
Yeah, a short time ago when I was coming in here, he was 3-2 up against the world champion Mark Williams. It was interesting that Eurosport put the graphic up before it started, and you probably saw this as well, Johnny. Ken Doherty was up as 25-year-old Ken Doherty, which would have made him a very sprightly man when he won the world championship in 1997. But he's played well. He won the first frame. He then went 2-1 down, got it back to 2-2 at the mid-session interval, and then put together a really good break of 50 to win the frame just before I came in to go 3-2 up. So it's 1st to 6, and if he wins, he goes into the last 32. And if you consider that the defending champion Mark Selby is already out, this would possibly put out the world champion as well. Maybe the draw opens up for Ken Doherty a bit if he can get through.
Yeah, Ken Doherty talking about his retirement plans in the Daily Star this morning. He says he's going to make his decision after the World Championships. Is it like one of these situations where if he starts to put a bit of form together, is he thinking to himself, God, I might do a little bit of a U-turn on this?
I do wonder, because you know, Ken was obviously at he had an anniversary dinner not that long ago, kind of at the end of last year, to celebrate 21 years since he won at the Crucible. And I did an event with him and Steve Davis, and Ken, to his credit, played extremely well that night, and I was starting to think retirement is not the way to go. And he's had a few ranking wins over the last year or two. He's got himself back to around 60th in the world again, ahead of the World Championships. Maybe a good showing at China could push him up a bit further as well. I think if you're Ken, you're coming into your 50th year. If you're still playing well, you keep playing. If he's lost the love of the sport, or he feels that he can't compete with the top, then maybe the time is right to retire. But I actually think there could be another year or two in Ken Doherty, and hopefully he can get a morale-boosting win this morning.
It's just gone 4-3 now there this morning. Final story you want to touch on is in the Belfast Telegraph this morning. They're saying that Ulster finally beat Leinster by signing Prop McGrath. So it's an exclusive by Jonathan Bradley here, saying that that deal will go through. It's a report, obviously, nothing confirmed just yet, and nothing overly surprising about this. I mean, he's trying to rejuvenate his career, he's trying to get a bit of game time.
Yeah, the graphic's a little bit small, so you probably missed the fact that in the middle of that copy they say Ulster didn't leave Dublin empty-handed at the weekend, and they suggest that the signing will be confirmed today. Like, we all saw the amount of shots that they went up to show Robbie Henshaw and Jonathan Sexton together in the stand. You could see McGrath behind them, left out of the squad entirely for the weekend, and you get the feeling that, you know, they've decided to put Ed Byrne over him at Leinster at this stage as backup. McGrath's fallen down the pecking order somewhat. To me, it seems crazy to let a former Lions prop go, but it's going to probably be to Ulster's benefit. He'll go up there, Marty Moore there, Jordy Murphy, John Cooney, plenty of former Leinster players who are going to be there. It'll probably help him bed into the club as well. And I think, much like Munster benefited from taking Leinster's maybe players who are out of favour, I won't say cast-offs, it'll probably be a big benefit if they get Jack McGrath.
So Jonathan Brady there, understanding that Jack McGrath will be confirmed as an Ulster player today. And one final tweet we just wanted to wrap up on. Off the Ball tweeted us earlier on a quote saying, "I think Liverpool have blown it, but after that I couldn't predict anything." I presume that was a quote from Johnny E. Ward here in studio. Brian Gartland has responded to that.
And, footballer, is it?
Yeah, and he's just quickly asked who said that, and we can confirm it was you, Johnny, wasn't it? I presume he doesn't agree with you.
What are you doing up this hour of the morning? You know, worry about Dundalk and your 2-1 win in the League Cup last night. Is he a Liverpool fan?
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe he disagrees with the idea that Liverpool have blown it.
The Liverpool have done incredibly well to be in with a shout, considering, in my view, if you were to rate Firmino, Mane and Salah as a front three this season, they'd be 6 out of 10 maybe in terms of what they can actually do. Salah's not had a good season at all, in my view. Firmino was on a drought before he scored at the weekend. Mane's been pretty decent, has made a lot of mistakes as well. And Liverpool do not score goals apart from those front three, basically. That's how they work. So the fact that they're still with a shout is incredible, but I think they've lost the initiative. I don't think they'll win the league.
Is that the same as blowing it, though?
No.
Have they blown it? They were in a situation where if they drew at the Etihad, they kind of were nearly halfway over the line and they lost that game, but they probably haven't blown it, but it's early in the morning.
Isn't blowing it very different, though? Isn't that more like Istanbul and the Chelsea slip up that year, where, you know, Liverpool were basically champions in waiting, City had an easy run in, but you knew that if Liverpool won those games they were going to win the league?
Yeah.
Like, even if Liverpool finished the season well, City could still win it on their own merit.
Yeah,
anyway.
And like, the points tally is so high. Like, Liverpool have 32 games, 79 points. That's an incredible points tally. But the Everton and Leicester games, Everton and West Ham games, that they really should have, they should have beaten Everton. You know, if Salah were on his game, they'd have beaten Everton, and they lost the initiative after that.
I still think the key moment in the title race was that ridiculous John Stones clearance in the Liverpool Manchester City game. Ultimately, is that Liverpool blowing it? I think it's a bit of luck from the City's perspective. It's it was such a strange moment leading up to that. It was a great Salah chance, if I recall correctly. And
Liverpool have gotten serious luck, though. Like the Jordan Pickford, we mentioned him earlier getting abuse from the
lads. That
was the most ridiculous goal ever. And the Spurs concession on Sunday wasn't far off. It was a terrible goal conceded at that level. And Liverpool, they were gone. Like, if they didn't get a win on Sunday, so I just genuinely don't think Liverpool have been playing well almost for the duration of 2019. I think they've been just about getting through games because their front three isn't really functioning, and Salah is not having a good season.
Is being top of the table at Christmas the football equivalent of winning the National League? But what I'm trying to say, what I'm trying to push this conversation into, is comparing Liverpool to Mayo.
Is there some sort of a Catholic Church curse as well in Liverpool? You know, I think statistically, though, if you're top of Christmas, you generally win the league. But statistically, you don't have a team on 77 points from 31 games that isn't top of the table. I mean, the top two's standards in terms of points is incredible. And Liverpool haven't, it's not that they bottle it, it's just that they haven't been playing quite well enough at the end of the season to win games that they would otherwise have won, I think, like Everton away.
Yeah, I think the key point in the bottling it discussion is that, you know, they were top of the table at Christmas, but never has there been a team second at Christmas as good as Manchester City, possibly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I think that's probably the key element in all of this.
Just going back to that Everton game, when Salah is through one-on-one in that game, you just don't expect him to score. And that wasn't just the case 12 months ago. Ever since the World Cup, he didn't get a break. He didn't play well at the World Cup. He wasn't right. He's done well to have as good a season as he had, but to me, he looks like... I mean, did you see the celebration after the goal on Sunday? It was all about Salah. Like, that was partly Salah, but it was mainly an absolute cock-up by Spurs.
Yeah.
And Salah put a speculative ball across that they should have dealt with.
I think he's gone back a little bit more towards his Roma form. That's not to say that, you know, Salah isn't still an excellent player, but one of the things about him, and particularly when Liverpool signed him, people thought there can be a little bit of a frustration about this guy. He gets in one-on-one, he tries to do a little bit too much, maybe he can be a little bit too greedy at times, and maybe, I think, just since Christmas, he snatched some of those chances as well.
Totally.
As Johnny said, last year he cut inside and almost second nature, he just curled the ball into the bottom corner of the far side. Now he's overthinking it, he's going in on one-on-ones and trying to do too much.
He should get a leaf from the Brian Gartland book. Brian Gartland for a defender, unbelievably good in front of goal, and I hope he's still listening this morning, obviously.
Yeah. Lads, thanks a million for popping into us this morning, Will and Johnny. We're back tomorrow morning from 7:45 a.m. Off the Ball, as always, on the radio tonight from 7 o'clock. They'll have Enda Stevens and David McGoldrick on the football show, and much, much more presides. Just to mention this, Off the Wall is our brand new Game of Thrones podcast with Andy Lee. It's brought to you by Discover Northern Ireland, and it is dropping later on today across Off the Ball. And we're going to bring you a clip tomorrow morning, but every Tuesday until the end of Season 8, which is coming up in just 2 weeks, we'll be bringing you our Game of Thrones pod with Andy Lee. He talks about the characters of Westeros in the same manner that he does about heavyweight boxers, it says in front of me here, which is great analysis indeed. We're back tomorrow morning, as I say, on OTB AM from 7:45 AM. We'll chat to you then. Bye-bye for now.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 AM.